Okay, welcome to meeting number 138 of the Jellicoe Literary Guild. And I'm going to note that what's especially nice about this meeting is that it contains these three people. We three people last had the Jellicoe Guild, just us, in April of 2010 in Portland. Oregon, as we now call it. The last time the three of us met, it was just before Cassie and I moved out here, and Victor drove us in the truck because he's a super trucker.
Retired super trucker. Now I'm legit trucker.
Now you're legit. Oh, I still like it as a nickname for you, like a superhero name, super trucker.
Yeah, I just do what I do is when I'm on the West Coast, I just pop down the truck stop, purchase myself an East Coast turnaround. Take that, drive over the East Coast, and then stop in the truck stop, West Coast turnaround, drive all the way back, make a lot of money, I look really paranoid.
So, we are now going to listen to flashbacks. So, the four flashbacks, the first one is pretty much purely for you guys to be entertained by. This is a meeting from 20 years ago. Down to Britain. What's particularly enjoyable about this flashback is I'm drunk.
Oh.
I'm drinking whiskey.
Oh, God.
And I sound very entertaining and exhausted. And then the other three are more familiar around.
The best things in life, my friend. Yeah. If you can give them to the birds and the bees, now give me money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want.
You know, make you feel better.
Money.
We can only hope, man. Oh, man, this is cool, man. This is cool. Yeah. This is one of the better ones, man. Everybody's drinking whiskey.
And singing, this will be the day that I die.
Yeah. Heather and Holly. And five fingers, no waiting. Oh, God, searching for those fucking guitar picks really dug it out of me. I can't do that no more, man. I'm cool. I was talking about searching for guitar picks and fingers.
I don't know what happened to those. I don't know. I brought those out to the Rockcast game. I think I would end up throwing them in the audience.
You were disgusted. Yeah, get more.
We have to see.
I have a poem about UFOs and sex when you get back. When you get back, you get beer too. You know, you can't just show up with your smiling self. You know. Yeah, let's throw it. I showed up at the window. Did you guys see me at the window earlier tonight laughing?
I heard you.
I was there. I thought I'd manifest extra-textually, as it were. I became a postmodern paradigm all into myself.
modern paradigm. Where's your ponytail?
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, I took my...
And
the
earring.
Yeah. Well, you have, to understand, you know, I can't take my pants off right now, but I do have a ponytail down there. It's just got real long and stuff. I just snuck the earring in there somewhere, but it kind of hurt. Yeah! That's what I want.
The short summary is that I've been doing newspapers and journals and making up stuff in my notebooks since I was about 10.
Cool.
Yeah. And then I started doing more of that, but then when I went to college, I kind of got away from it and actually worked with real people on college magazines and stuff rather than just stuff in my notebooks. That eventually led to me knowing enough people to do a journal, and so in 1995, which is my favorite story about this, I decided, okay, well, I'm not in school anymore, but I know a bunch of people who write and stuff, and we have gatherings, like this gathering is sourced in those gatherings. I went out and bought a Canon desktop photocopier for $500. $500 now would get you, I don't know what compared to then, but this was like just it was a square, let me get it in the camera. It was a little square photocopier. You lift up the lid and it goes, yeah, technology. And so the first Seneca, which was 59 issues ago, was very much a sort of a cut and paste typewriter affair. There was no computers involved, just a little Canon photocopier. Anyway, so this 15 years later, this was made with so many different programs. I can't even list them all, but I think that in some ways it still is the same production. It's just fancier.
Fanciful orchid. Not when hanging onto the running boards of four-cylinder Fords, or when painting in red colors in the middle of the night, or when creeping with broken bones beneath blowhung paint pitched against the winter dome, but now, all at once, that he realizes his best years are now gone. There were days of reflection and other days, more ragged and with frayed ends, when he took photographs of wallflower women whose pale hands held bouquets of their own flowers. Days when the fires rose around them and she said, stand and deliver, while he thought about the Savior. They made a record once when he was 24, but he ain't 24 anymore. He is me and she is you, caught in a moment of revelation, and these things of which we seem constitute us, the proud moment, and the slippers laying down on the salty rails like godfathers of the railroad.
This is from a little zine called Tippy Must Die.
That's
it. Yes. And this is entitled, Whatever Happened To? Whatever happened to Beaker from The Muppet Show? I saw him in a porno movie doing Tori Welles. Me, 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 he said. Me, 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 she moaned. He's got a tattoo of a snake on his pelvis, doing her in the slow-mo while the cheesy punka-punka music was throbbing in the back. Yet, like all Muppets, he had no nipples, just a smooth, puffy, foam-rubber chest. How did this happen? When Henson died, things just got weird, Beaker seemed to say. Of course, the only thing he actually said was, me, me, me. But we could tell by his eyes what he meant. Beaker, like the rest of the cast, lost track of Dr. Bunsen Honeydew, but heard a rumor that Honeydew was slain in a drive-by shooting. One can only speculate whether crack cocaine was involved. Sorry about that.
All right.
Do you know that I'm a puppeteer?
Oh, well, then there you go. That 8 strikes home.
So do you know any rumors about what happened in it? Can you confirm the crack cocaine thing?
No, but I do agree about the nickel situation.
Okay, so back in this first issue, I'm just going to read you a little tiny piece of what my thinking was like then, since we're about to look at issue number 100. That's tonight's number. Yeah. I had some really... I would put them nicely, delusional ideas of what was possible to do from the obscurities of one's and pre-internet.
Fuck yeah.
But I had all sorts of ambitions.
Thank God for that shit.
And so there's a certain sweetness and funniness about this. So I opened this first issue with a letter to a friend of mine, and here's just a couple of paragraphs from it, just to give you a little taste of what was in my head at the time when I wasn't drinking the whiskey.
All right. How old were you?
95. I was 31. I'd just gotten my master's in English at Northeastern, and I still had like lots of book stuff in my head. I was working at a bookstore. I hadn't really traveled much at this point. I just like gone from Connecticut to Boston. That was my big deal. So anyway, just a taste of this. And this is about the people that were on that tape that we were listening to, his voices. I believe our group of writers, artists, and musicians to be a significant one, that our monthly or so event at New Britain's Roma restaurant is something worth commemorating in print. I also believe we have to do this ourselves. At one time, 9 years ago, I hoped to involve myself in the publishing world on a paid professional basis, write for the Atlantic Monthly or some such. No more. I won't pour my work for gain. I don't damn the publishing business for others, but my own rejection of it is permanent. Between power-hungry fascist liberal academics and multinational corporate jackal publishers, the state of contemporary American literature is in grave peril. My response? Publish a journal paid for from my own pocket, nurture the talents and goals of my friends within its pages and at the jail field. I will carry forth the tradition as I see fit in my small way. I will endeavor to make connections on a person-by-person basis to widen my circle. I will retain total control of my projects and treat my colleagues with respect and love. If I have to work at a cash register for many years to come to finance those efforts, so be it. So that's
still the same Raymond I know.
That's Raymond plus LSD plus the internet.
That's the same.
Plus a little time. So anyway, I was thinking about this issue number 100, and it got to the point last Saturday where I spent like 9 hours editing all the pieces in here, and I was pretty burnt, but I had this thing to write, so I just decided to dive in without much ado. And here's the 100th issue piece. July 15, 2017, 11:10 p.m., Cafe Bene, Mass Ave, Boston, Mass. This is issue number 100 of The Cenacle, and welcome. It's taken 22 years and a few months to arrive at this point in this periodical's history. I've been mulling recently how to approach writing this piece. Spent the whole of today into tonight reading and editing the material that will comprise this issue. Then, the last couple of hours, reading through Cenacles number 1 to 12, dated from April 95 to June 96. They were dear and mostly longtime souls known to me in those early issues. Burke, Bergeron, Dylan, Charette, Emerson, Aoki, Heitner, Amante, Brandon. Friends from my college days in Connecticut, Brandon and McLaughlin too, and Amante for that matter, come along when I moved to Boston in 92. We drank together, shared each other's lives and art, wrote about each other, gathered 8 times a year at Roma Restaurant for our Jellicoe Literary Guild meetings. I love them all. I treasured their art, all of them, but Burke lives yet somewhere in the world. All of them are far away from me tonight, have been for a long time. So those early Cenacles are a complex portrait of a time and a place, a sort of a set of friends, a sadness in the passage of time, and yet, we shared those nights of art, which I recorded, we shared the pages of this periodical, which exists yet, the Jellicoe Guild exists, too. What I want to say to all those names, that are no more than names to most reading these pages, is, I haven't forgotten any of you, or those glorious old years, and I thank you and treasure you still. I learned no easier than most that life is change and growth and loss. The intimacies and ecstasies of one or many days and nights can, often does, spend out over time. Things change. And I've also learned how the heart's memories persist, not just of people, of course, places, possessions, nature, dreams, and desires. My friend Jim Burke III would often say to me, "We are who we were, but not who we will become." And he would laugh his big man's laugh, his blue-green eyes sparkling. He remains, years after his passing, the wisest, deepest, dearest, and funniest person I've ever known. But what did he mean by that? It's like he was saying that all we've been arrives us to now, but is not equal to now. He was a great lover of mathematics, and this statement seems to mix that love with his love of Eastern thought, mescaline, LSD, and every Irishman's fondness for a well-turned phrase. So the me that has arrived to this page is and is not the editor of the previous 99 issues of this journal. What to do with this? If anything at all, maybe I am all those Soulards. But ignited by this moment, live now, not what I was, because none of those previous me's had experienced this moment. Maybe this is a good thought on the matter. Maybe I'm overthinking it. I miss those people, those days, yet one begins to stumble and fall by too often looking backwards. I cherish the writers in this issue, too. I cherish how my beloved Cassie has made it look so wonderful. What The Cenacle is to me is a beautiful series of recordings of what bits of time and space were like to me and people I was lucky enough to know. Some of the best bits of it all. To all of you who shared 100 issues of this periodical with me, I say, you've bettered my life, you've salved my heart, you've helped to make me the artist I've wished to be. Thank you.
Now you can wipe away, dab away my tears.
Oh.
Yeah. Joe Coleman, no lullabies. These dreary hours between 2 and 4 a.m. are the realm of the King of Despair. This is when elastic time makes clocks appear unreliable, when every tick-tock is amplified. This is when the blistered angels sort the harvest of night prayers and scatter them unanswered to the stars. When psychic vandals spray graffiti on the walls of delusion, when sleeplessness murmurs names no one will deny, this is when only street lamps see dark shapes and cast a shadow populace haunting its dreary hours. When traffic signals blink their electric candy warnings over poisonous avenues, this is when the alley paths are splashed anew with piss, vomit, and tears of ghosts. When everything sounds like the end of an alto sax solo fading away eternally into the distance. It is the time of lonely echoes from nowhere. It is the time most colors surrendered, black, grays, and blacks. This is when everything feels like the last passenger on the last train reaching the last stop. In no hurry to stand up, climb the stairs, and stumble home the next day at home. And stumble home, since the next day at home is every day as new. As those dreary hours between 2 and 4 a.m., when we should be in bed having nightmares. I like that. That's good.
It's good.
That's really good.
That was the best one you sent me. But it's a really dark place.
He's got a real rhythm there. I like it. This is when elastic time makes clocks appear unreliable, when every tick-tock is amplified. This is when blistered angels sort the harvest of night prayers and scatter them unanswered to the stars. When psychic vandals spray graffiti on the walls of delusion, when sleeplessness murmurs names mourning will deny. This is when only streetlights see dark shapes that cast the shadow populace haunting these dreary hours. When traffic signals blink their electric candy grid warnings or poisonous avenues. Love is like, this is when the alley paths are splashed anew with piss, vomit, tears of ghosts. Everything sounds like the end of an alto sax solo, which is very hastily said. Fading away eternally into the distance. It is. This is really good. I like this a lot.
Yeah.
It is the time of lonely echoes from nowhere. It is the time most colors surrender to grays and blacks. This is when everything feels like the last passenger on the last train, reaching the last stop. In no hurry to stand up, climb the stairs, and stumble home, since the next day at home is every bit as bleak. As these dreary hours between 2 and 4 a.m., when we should be in bed, nightmares.
All right, so I'm going to read to you notes from New England. Through the door in the wall, 20 years of tripping. The following is a version of some of the events that occurred to me back in 1997, the first year I tried LSD. I recently dived into many of my old notebooks, trying to dig into daylight again who I was back then. Let old pages reveal anew how my path has shifted and shifted again and again because of my experiences that year. I was near 34 years old when my psychedelic adventures began on April 5th, 1987.
April.
Rather, God is everything that exists, though everything that exists is not God. It is present in everything, and everything comes into being from it. Nothing is devoid of its divinity. Everything is within it. It is within everything and outside of everything. There is nothing but it. Yesterday, after a long, exhausting week of bookseller work, I had jury duty. Picked to be on the jury for an assault and kidnapping case, despite my protests, but then dismissed free to leave and escape the minions of state power manifested. So last night, I celebrated with the dollar glass Portugal red wine at my favorite current bar, Eddie's Place in Cambridge. In the wood-paneled back room, pumping the jukebox with quarters to hear Leonard Skinner's Sweet Home Alabama, Bob Seger's Like a Rock, The Who, Aerosmith, Tom Petty, and the like. Waiting for Rick. I remember thinking, when I was 17, I could have joined the race of men, but it didn't happen. My parents taught me nothing of the world and how to travel it well. Jenny smiled and turned me down. And so I sought love in a clumsy, stumbling way, each new encounter emphasizing my ignorance, my inadequacy. Ever struggling with these old angers and woes, not knowing a way to solve them new. Mud and certainty, then, now. Rick finally came and we escalated the red wine night higher and higher. He had a Jack Kerouac book to shout from, too, and there were dart words, too, on the wall to try, higher and higher. And then a moment on snowy Carnal Street, near my studio apartment in Zombie Town, long and dark, but for occasional street lamps, deserted buildings, when he kneeled and kissed the pavement, grazing everything. He then reclined back in a small hill of snow, like a drunken winter king, and asked me if I live in faith or doubt, demanded that I kneel to and praise everything. So I did. All is well and divine, he cried to the strange, quiet, mysterious street. We lay later in my studio apartment, him and my beetle futon, me and my old beat mattress, talking of death, deciding neither of us was at peace enough or ready for it. He told me he was visiting his friend Hartley the next evening in Melrose, the richer town next to Zombie Town, and so I should come and meet him too. Some kind of crazy psychedelic visionary. So today I saw David Cronenberg's film Crash, a really fucked up movie about sex and car crashes. Now headed for Hartley's house, wondering what drugs will be taken and what experiences will come. Just took acid. Notes. Nothing yet. High as high. No other. There is no we. There is no I. Pages of poetry, all blank. There is no here. The night went on forever. I'll never forget it to my last day. I was with safe people. Hartley's face changing skin color. Caucasian to Latin to black. My friend looked like Bill Cosby at one point that first night. He doesn't look really exactly like Bill Cosby. He doesn't look like a black guy. But he morphed into Bill Cosby. Whoa.
Happens sometimes.
It happens. Yeah. Back and forth. And he went back and forth. His skin color kept changing. Desktop computer screen scaring me. Grateful Dead music for hours making sense now. The tribalism of their shows, people traveling with their tours for months on end. Part of a new community I can only imagine. Hartley's happy memories of those tours back in the 70s. The music is something sacred and beautiful and fun. And fun in the heart of it all. Hartley loves the lyrics to the Dead song, Eyes of the World. Wake up to find you are the eyes of the world. The heart has its beaches, its homeland, and thoughts of its own. Wake now, discover that you are the song that the morning brings. But the heart has its seasons, its evenings, and songs of its own. I made it through, I think. Late on, probably reading aloud from trashy bestsellers for our entertainment, Rick smiling mysteriously, looking both dead and alive. Night ending by mutual consent. Early morning, sleep. I was and am grateful to these two men in a unique or mutual way. They saw me safely through the door. Next day afternoon, they're out getting bagels and movies to rent, and I'm here listening to sad classical music, Beethoven, I think, and seeing if I can still write. And I think I can, though not very well at the moment. Rick was reading from Dylan Thomas poetry earlier. My tears are like the quiet drift of petals from some magic rose, and all my grief flows from the rift of unremembered skies and snows. I think that if I touch the earth, it would crumble. It is so sad and beautiful, so tremulously like a dream. I stepped through the door finally, and lastly, and there isn't any going back, even if I wish to, it's confirmed. Tripping, laughing, talking, it's all okay. Now the music is sprightly and beautiful. Thinking also about art and discipline and devotion and gift and tenacity. To Hartley. ground that is never absent to wishing lips, enough sunrise to console 3 a.m.'s dark prayer, the sadness you keep after a moment of crowded woe, the will to meet eyes and hopes for bells your glance provokes. Absent God, absent lover, absent mother, worse present all at once, art a horn cleaving your heart as you dangle in reddening darkness. That's my first acid poem. Not that it means anything.
I liked it.
Yeah.
But I like you. You're kind of an asshole.
Yeah.
So I, it says I have subjective taste in some people.
That's right.
No, I don't know. What's your opinion on that, Cassie?
Thank you. That's very
good. I like your first episode.
Which
it
one?
It sounds like you.
Yeah. Yeah, I was sitting there in his living room, and they were all getting bagels, and I was like writing in my notebook, trying to write something poetical about what was happening.
That's fucking, that's a hard exercise.
It was a very hard thing.
It's a very hard exercise.
And
express genuine intent.
And it couldn't have happened with two better guys and a better night and a better.
No, and then there has to be a certain sort of idealism. So that's what this thing's set up properly.
Drugs, pens, sex, music, books, movies, pictures. What else? God, death. Tripping and needing all of today to land, knowing that one's obsession's like an old coat, necessary, ugly, all you've got really. A few days later, near midnight. Bench in Copley Square, near Boston Public Library, the insanely tall and weirdly blue Hancock Tower, the pretty old Trinity Church, worrying, amounting to not much. All is well and divine, I'm trying. Mine is a sloppily contrived life whose only solid hope lies in art. I'll be gone from my bookseller job soon. 3+ years of working there amounting only to paying my rent and bills every month. I'll be a graduate student again this fall, this time Emerson College, this time MFA in creative writing. Can I do this? Taking acid showed me that art is illusion, but I've decided I do not believe this. Art is a path. Acid is a path. You see, art has been and is my only hope. Not love or religion or money or even friendship. Beyond all these for me is art. Beyond art is silence and annihilation. I choose life. I choose art. Dropping acid disturbed me deeply, but that's okay. I go on and may take acid again if I have the chance. 11. So, now Carnell Street off enjoyed steps of defunct Rome Tech building. Years me living in Zombie Town, Mass, old factory town just north of Boston, poorer than the towns nearby like Milrose. Street lit up by many street lamps, their strange humming. The night is mild and peaceful, me coming to the usual conclusions. Art is sacred, art is all, art is the path, art is the means, art is the destination. Cars pass by once in a while, at peace right now to reflect, to appreciate the pine tree near these steps, to enjoy the mild air. I'm 13 again, delivering newspapers before dawn, all is well and divine. May. So I've only tripped once so far. From Huxley's Doors of Perception, which is also in this issue, in full. It's the LSD issue of the Cynical, I decided. Or I decided that along the way, and I'm aiming it toward that. But the man who comes back through the door on the wall will never be quite the same as the man who went out. He'll be wiser but less cocksure, happier but less self-satisfied, humbler in acknowledging his ignorance, yet better equipped to understand the relationship of words to things, of systematic reasoning to the unfathomable mystery which it tries forever vainly to comprehend.
Fuck, I like that a lot.
Isn't that?
Fuck.
Yeah? That's fucking Huxley. My two heroes were Leary and Huxley, which is really kind of like...
Yeah, they were kind of counter.
Very different. Harley's house, 5 a.m., late on in second acid trip with him. A warping long day into night, walking through a local drugstore, nearly lost in the candy aisle. More early Grateful Dead music. A box of rain will ease the pain, and love will see you through. Another pretty song. Simpsons, King of the Hill, X-Files.
Yes.
Acid starting to hit during X-Files, but it was okay. Mulder finds irrefutable proof of aliens. Spooky shit. Later on, talk of technology, the internet, the inner spaces of humanity. Harley maintained that the internet is useful and possibly politically expedient. This is in 97. I counter with a lot of mucky metaphysical talk, somewhat wild-eyed romantic, somewhat bitter idealist, somewhat simply whacked. Images whirling in my mind of dinosaur bone clockmaker versus man on the moon. Art as eternity wrapped by tight cord of ego. Whirling. Crazy motherfucker, whirling. It was fun. Exhausting. Heard Don, those guys sleeping, I was on a couch, comfortable, writing a little, reading a book called Hallucinogens and Culture about Native American tribes and their ritual use of peyote to salve, to praise. I know what I do out in the functioning world can be less painful than what I do now, a family technical bookstore gone corporate greedy, getting my sorry hippie ass shoved inch by inch, day by day, them not knowing yet that I'll be going by my own will soon. Surviving there till I escape its potent, destructive illusion. Every day I go there, the old call of the abyss ever pulling at me, crying, you're worthless, you're shit nothing, but uncertainty. I'm not going to Emerson to learn how to sell my work. My work is not for sale. I'm not going to change it for anyone or anything. I know it matters that when I'm writing what I want and how I want, on the other side of the door, floating through the cosmos, falling through what is beneath all else, whose pulse and light manifest as our world. When I'm there, now here, the world now here, as it should be, and who is to say anything but? I hope I'm brave enough to risk deeper voyages into inner space and make peace with their apparent irrelevancy to the workaday world. The birds are singing, dawn is coming, all is well and divine here and now, and tomorrow after that. August.
Next day.
Next day.
Reality sets in.
Yeah, this is totally. Okay, this is from Rainer Maria Rilke, one of my favorite poets. There's only one thing you should do. Go into yourself. Find out the reason that commands you to write. See whether it has spread roots into the very depths of your heart. Confess to yourself whether you would have to die if you were forbidden to write. This most of all, ask yourself in the most silent hour of your night, must I write? Dig into yourself for a deep answer. If this answer rings out in assent, if you meet this solemn question with a strong, simple, I must, then build your life in accordance with this necessity. Your whole life, even unto its humblest and most indifferent hour, must become a sign and witness to this impulse. All right, so this is August,
Howard.
Harley's house, mushroom trip that lasted until 5 a.m. or so. It was cool. Reading to him Rick's crazy letters from his new home in Seattle. And here's one quoted directly from one of Rick's letters at the time. And my life becomes ever more circular as here I am back at the Panama Hotel, where I last lived from October 90 to May 91, and I'm in the room right next to the one I formerly occupied, a so-called outside room, in that the window doesn't face another room in the interior of the building but looks out onto a parking lot, a weed-covered hill beyond, a freeway beyond that, I-5, the major north-south thoroughfare along the entire west coast, and a major swath of cloudy blue northwestern sky as far as the eye can see. I'm delighted to be here, alone, independent, healthy, solvent, anonymous, and so very grateful. Finally get into my poetry as never before. My intuition and desire tells me that my time is now in the sense of throwing myself fully into writing and reading aloud. I would like to meet some of the poets and drinkers while I'm here, be it for 1 month or a year, and now that I'm able to have this space alone, I can begin to actively direct my passions to that end.
What was that?
That was 97. Then strange, not like LSD in that it was more familiar. No voyage beyond Pluto this time. More a voyage to a here and now, far faster than ordinarily perceived. Watching Harley's stereo dance to its music, designs in the living room armchair and couch undulating friendly too. Later outside, on the front steps, watching a patch of green lawn dance and breathe. Shadows on it becoming gullies, all real seeming. Little of the abstract, psychedelic at this point. Grateful for the trees, bushes, grass, for the stars above, seeing more, many more of them than usual. Slept into a dream version of Harley's familiar living room. Him there, and strange figures, too. Then sweaty, colorful patterns, electrical currents, strange, heavily rhythmic music, deep bass guitar, and harsh voices, yet eyes open in just Hartley's dark living room, where all is still and quiet and seems ordinary. Eyes closed again, the colors and music and voices give way to a timeless place, soundless, sightless, and forever behind everything, calm beyond calm. Then exhaustion passing me to some more familiar dreaming. Peripheral view of two small stars beneath shaggy brown sunlight, above soft motion, soft secrets, all freely floating, green leaves and wind, until an intending hand, dizzied by small stars, introduces sunlight to water, softness to delight. Party fuck-ass hard for days after leaving bookseller job. Scared of everything I am of the future, but a month to gear up mentally for Emerson College, make ready as I am able. It will be strange there. Deeper states of consciousness is what I'm really aiming at. Tribalism. New kind of community. I need to get further into this regardless of how Emerson goes.
It's like 97, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Shit's still kind of happening.
I've done so much thus far, but faster, harder, deeper, better art. September. Carnal Street, tripping, inside trip, here is trip. Time distortions, paranoia, heightened, every sensory perception, feeling of intense oddness.
That's an oceanic experience.
Yeah. A long weekend at Harley's house, many hours smoking the green and releasing deeper into the tunes, led to a Monday trip, him showing me the virtual synthesizer he downloaded off the internet, him jamming on it for hours as we rolled deeper into trip, at one point playing his guitar along to it. Amazing stuff. His computer's desktop images growing in and around and through the music. I left his place at nighttime, and it all got stranger then. I'm tripping. I'm walking along, but not moving. The five-minute walk from his house to the train station is taking forever. Dealing with getting on the train is strange, but not hard. Then suddenly I'm in Zombie Town, going down train station stairs to exit the street. Now what? Lost down side streets, standing at one point just writing, going to the all-night grocery store, buying some food and some soda, learning how to function under acid, as Ken Kesey advised. Now go, get to Carnal Street. It will be safer and make more sense. Get there and start writing. Near midnight, 9197, tripping on Carnal Street. Now 1,000 miles long, but benign. It's a motherfucker's world. But Carnal Street, still benign. How many cars cheats Arab silence? They cream rawly and fast. Crush under wheels the lamppost, and watch. A cricket, a lamppost, sheared raw air, a pen combining two shadows now, even where shadows well, there is hope. Ready to walk along the music again, ready to meet elongated smile, ready to greet the spirits again, and what, and then. It's a motherfucker's world. I told me acid, it told me so. Risings and fallings, perfumes and sunsets, the lampposts and told me so. I've always loved that phrase, they told me acid, told me so. Because I always think that was how I expressed my relationship to acid. It's internal, external. Anyway. Back on Carnal Street, Rome Tech steps, remembering the acid high night a few nights ago. Lights bore messages from UFOs. Cops were present, though hidden. Took a lot of concentration to make my way toward home. Passed through the ancient cemetery, happy as always at this to and from train passage, acknowledging the spirits there, grateful for them, daunted by the trees above me, how high, how great, continued home, arriving later watching my studio apartment shimmy, my standing lamp rise miles into the air above me. Acid instructs its user in the infinite of the interior and the unfathomable strangeness of the world. Similar psychedelic plants, peyote mushrooms, and their like, grow naturally all over the world and have been part of human religious ceremonies forever. Used respectfully, they reveal walls, open doors in those walls where once was but seeming mundanity. Are these substances necessary to trip into the God, become obviously infinite? No, but is prayer necessary to commune with the sacred? Is witnessing miracles necessary to prove all creation miraculous? Must I tell my loved ones I love them for them to be certain? Our society wars with doubt, with selfishness, with laziness, with the inner beast and the inner angel within each of us. LSD, like God, like art, like love, like deepest grief, overwhelms us with our vastness, our great, big, tiny vastness. We need salving. We wish to praise. Carnal Street, empty, lit, street lamps and spotlights and weeds and electrical poles. Burn down the mission. Burn it down to stay alive, sings Elton John on my Walkman. Yes, yes, piano full of friendly brawl. The past, the unknown. I have to represent the unreasonably mystical, magical approach to art at Emerson. Acid, deep woe, and high laughter. I've been so high in my life on pen, so high in the sight of unknown pink cheeks, so high on the barroom laughter of friends, so high in foolish hopes smoked from imaginary pipes. A fool, a clown, an angel. God is green, grows from the ground. All is mud uncertainty. Along Carnal Street, dead with joy. Lights glow, blow, flash, fling, yes. They've blown me aloft, made me a shimmy. I'm a humming light, a dancing ring. Brother to the pine, the pulse, joy, every woe. Glow, blow, flash, fling, yes. Random chunks pass by, metal and flesh. I see the wind rise up, brush souls. I see the wind touch skin, offer kisses of hope. I hmm, I dance, I wish them all well.
Fuck you, Huckleberries.
November, I'd love to turn you on, the Beatles. I have thought about how amazing it must have been to hear that song in 1967 when it was new, A Day in the Life.
Yeah, that was, I can only picture Beatles, but they were never things. I understood them better as I got older.
Yeah. But it must have been amazing to buy in your local record shop by the most popular band on the planet an album that concluded with the phrase, I'd love to turn you on.
Yeah. I could only freaking...
That is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to know where Now was invented, for better or for worse, it was from that. Today's trajectory was toward acid. Nothing else really mattered. I wanted to trip, and did tonight. I spent the afternoon reading my recent acid notes, poems, looking for what was going on with me, what patterns emerging, what could coming, starting to shape them into writings I'll submit to my workshops, no matter how poorly they are received or written. Nobody seems to care what my work is about. Just that my poems lack titles, and they don't seem interested in figuring out what sells these days. What are they about, they keep asking me. Acid, music, metaphysics, and pussy, I answer, with a helpful smile. Went over to Harley's house, got high as hell, but wanted acid, shy to ask, did. He was fine with it, preferred mushrooms this time for himself. We launched in. Listened to the strangest records, room danced and shimmied, wondered about art and what's its point. Realized how big the gulf between people like me and Hartley and most others. I complained to him about my writing workshops that seemed like test markets for selling writing more than anything about beauty, wisdom, or mystery. What did LSD teach me this time? Preliminary conclusion, art is precious and vulnerable and losable. Also, you must give to receive, person by person, everyone you can. And when alone, invest. When not alone, invest. Praise everything despite. These are lessons vast and deep, which take me forever, which will take me forever to work with. So fuck it if I'm poor, lonely, navel-gazing over my flaws. No one at Emerson is going to care if I stop writing. Feeling lousy, pursued, fucked up, or whatever, I must defend what is mine. If my writing doesn't represent me well, nothing else will. No other way to do things, but the best one knows how. I hated being in that writing program. I have never felt so at odds with people. I mean, I've been at odds with people because, like, we have no common ground. But I've never been at odds with people with whom I have so much common ground. And it was really torturous. I was in two graduate writing workshops. And they just drove me out of my fucking mind.
That's the way I felt when I met my brothers.
They drove you out of your fucking mind?
Yeah, trying to make sense of the fucking thing.
Yeah.
Very similar, I think.
They were very frustrating experiences because the people I think the people in those workshops wanted something very different from what I wanted. They just wanted to learn how to...
That was the same fucking conclusion I had to come to.
Yeah, yeah. I had to learn that what they wanted to do is they wanted to sell their writing skills, whether that be in the form of, like, creative writing or otherwise. They wanted to do that for a living. And so that's why they were in that program at Emerson. They were there to learn how to make a living at writing. And I wasn't there to make a living at writing. I was there escaping the fucking world.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't figure out a way to make my way in it. Also, I was doing lots of acid, which was telling me that the world that I was not having a good time adjusting to was really fucked up. So anyway, it was a tumultuous time.
Yeah.
I mean, the point of it was is that I went from working to being in graduate school, and I was doing acid along the way. And the acid was showing me that the structures and the hierarchies that I was part of were artificial. First, I saw that in the corporate world in the early part of the year, and then I saw in the academic world in the later part of the year. And I couldn't communicate this to anybody. I had one friend who I emerged from all that with who understood. We tripped together at the end of the semester.
Yeah.
But everybody else was just not, they didn't get it. They didn't get it. I was going down into Britain at this time to the Jellicle Guild meetings with Jim and my other friends, and we were having these really raucous, wonderful times, you know, art, alcohol, friendship. It was all about fraternity. And then I'd come to these writing workshops where people were just petty and bickering and...
There's a good stress and a bad stress.
It was bad.
There's the good competition and there's the bad fucking competition.
Yeah, and this is like...
And this is shit competition, feels like shit competition.
And it did feel like shit competition.
Good,
and it was
creative
hard.
Energy always feels like the fucking creative energy.
The worst part about it is that I'd done it to myself. I knew that going into an MFA creative writing program was going to be the wrong idea, but I had no choice. I was kind of like in a corner. I didn't want to keep working in bookstores. I needed to get out of the working world.
Yeah, well...
The only way to do that was to borrow money to go to school. I was awed, because the world had opened up to me in a way that nothing else had ever done for me before. Everything else had been disappointing, except for art. But that was inside of me. There had been nothing that was, like, out there that I could grapple with in that same way. And when I met LSD, it's like, whoa! Holy fuck! I'm humble in the face of this. I'm like on the ground, and I'm happy to be on the fucking ground in the face of this. And I'll fucking crawl because it's so wonderful. It's worth crawling for. So
just be a part of it.
I had to learn. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, but it was good. I called it walking the humble path.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I was really full of myself. I'm still full of myself, but I was full of myself in ways that I don't think I am anymore. Because I think that LSD really humbled me to my very blatant, in my own mind, imperfections and limitations.
I think at certain points in our life, we realize how much more of a servant that we want to be.
Much more?
Of a servant that we want to be.
Of a servant?
Yeah.
Observant?
Servant.
Observant.
You know, your responsibilities to life as
human. Oh, yeah. Sure. So anyway, the extracurricular commentary is that I was walking around in a state of wonder,
right.
But I could not communicate this to anybody around me.
And it can't last.
No, it couldn't last, but I didn't care. I mean, as far as I was concerned, I'd left the mainstream. And it wasn't ever going back. And I haven't. So, December. Psychedelics are illegal, not because a loving government is concerned that you may jump out of a third-story window. Psychedelics are illegal because they dissolve opinion structures and culturally lay down models of behavior and information processing. They open you up to the possibility that everything you know is wrong.
And also could be incredibly funny sometimes.
Terrence McKinn.
And then...
Awesome. Home, past 1 a.m., watching TV all night. Star Trek Next Generation, Millennium, Doctor Who, Winnie the Pooh. Now for the first completely solo acid trip. My standing lamp has the red light Rick gave me for such nights as this. Incense burning. Window shades to the right of my desk open. Lit up tree branches outside. Raining earlier. Shiny night. Put on my pants. Keys in my pocket. Just in case of something. Sure, I'm a little scared. Yes, it's magnificently psychedelic keys to ascension on my stereo. Notebooks ready. Chewing a piece of blotter. Masticate, masticate, hardly instructed. After a while, the page is read, undulates. A few days later, and in the semester writing workshop party, good riddance to it all. I did find one real friend, like a jewel in the dust named Joe. He writes poems that are unique, strange, exciting, and he came out with me after boring party to Zombie Town to trip. We studied the train tracks running parallel to Carnell Street, the ancient cemetery I daily passed through, the nearby river. To my studio apartment to listen to electronic music, he picked up my long unused guitar, started banging out Bob Dylan tunes. Restless, he left at dawn. We hugged, felt bonded in the unique way trips seem to create. This semester of writing workshops taught me, among other things, that I could function in literary mainstream America, but I don't want to. I think I'll do better with the publishing classes I've signed up for next semester. Maybe I'll learn better how to use the cynical as a way to offer myself to the new kind of community I'm seeking, a safe, encouraging place for sometimes hard, sometimes weird, but meaningful art, a vehicle for spreading the word of the new tribalism I'm sure is out there. It's okay to be happy is scrawled on the old chalkboard in a corner of my studio apartment, an acid revelation, but how? I'm still trying to figure that out. I don't know further, somehow, all is well and divine. I'm still learning this. That's who I was in 1997. 20 years ago.
I know that guy, Raymond.
Yeah. You definitely... I was him when you met me. So, I've recently become online friends with this girl named Tamara Miles. She's lives in South Carolina, and she's a very interesting person. She's a teacher. She's kind of like Jude. She's smart and writes poetry, and so she's
a communicator.
Yeah. She's fun to talk to because she's really smart and she's interesting and she cares about other people and she's a really good poet. How to draw the earth? Draw a candle within a circle, a match with which to light the candle, a man holding the match, woman blowing out the match, dog on a rug observing. The dog jumps up and runs around in the circle, knocks the woman down, the man confused, chaos, darker. Scratch the pencil across the page, heavy lines swirling, circle on fire. Water to put it out, more water. Let your thoughts be blue, blue-green, algae, coral reef. On the shoreline, houses. You inside one, a temporary dwelling, drawing by candlelight, an earth-like planet. Dog outside leaps through water, jellyfish, shark, whale, octopus, Millie Earhart's plane circling, looking for a place to land, a desert island, an SOS. Over there, a glacier or two, mountain, wise man at the top, using his last match to build a fire, warm your hands. That's fucking awesome. That is fucking awesome. That dropped my fucking jaw, man. Like, holy fucking shit. That is good. I was just like, God damn. This is... Because every good poet I know, I publish. And every time I find a new one, I publish them immediately.
You do.
And I haven't found one in a while of her quality. She's just really fucking good. Her and Ace Bogus is the other guy I found online. And he's a totally different trip from her. But they are both fucking phenomenal. Just phenomenal poets. They make me feel grateful to publish them. And I tell them that. And we have this bond. It's an online bond, but it seems really sincere.
Right. I get it. It doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah. Because, I mean, they see the magazine that Cassie designs and builds around their poems, and they know it's for real. It's nice. Anyway.
So I'm going to take the left turn on what I'm going to read tonight at this moment. And I'm going to read from a guy who I met online. His name is Patrick Jean Frank. I somehow encountered him on Facebook. He's one of these, he lives in North Carolina, out in the sticks. And he
he writes stuff that's kind of like very folksy and sort of amateurish.
Right.
So imagine you're sitting in the North Carolina Hills Mountains, in a trailer park, and you got this guy, big looking guy in his 60s, maybe.
Is he in his 60s?
I don't know. He's older. So this guy's work, it was just a labor of love for a guy that is like he's one of fucking America's forgotten. A fake smile is easier to spot than a meteor flashing across the sky. A turtle attempting to cross I-26, lost in a dream, but we could not stop. Bless the children, bless the working poor, bless those who engage in straight talk. I like that one. Buried in paperwork, I need the feel of the hawk, the mountain, the slanted light. This is a good one. Fiona, our PTSD cat, now sleeping peacefully beside me, a break in her misery. I drove past the pool hall and sex shop on Route 25, and death came to mind. It actually feels good to scrape the bottom of the barrel once in a while. I remember when I used to hit rock after rock over the back fence as a kid. I wonder why at this moment I feel peace and the cicadas are singing deep inside. Music and the cry of the dove and the distant stars keep me whole. My last gig could be sitting cross-legged on the sidewalk playing bare bones guitar. There are people who secretly think they are Christ, and they are either lying or crazy. That's kind of, yeah. He was just like a project I took on.
How about more?
Sacred geometry. I need geometry of our love. I thread myself into your theorem. Its synopsis held tight in your throat across your proud octagonal heart. 8 sides to our every argument, all logic cast aside for pure art. The matter decided by our shapes, properties, relative possessions, by the lines we draw around ourselves, by the dark space that keeps us apart.
Yeah, she's good.
Unnatural. You sound hoarse, said the ear, nose, and throat doctor as he examined my broken nose. The result of my automobile curling off the road into the concrete culvert around 5 in the morning. When I was too sleepy to be driving and my face hit the steering wheel or maybe the windshield. I don't remember, but the blood flowed until a nice man came out of his house and told me to hold my head back, squeeze my nostrils, and try to be calm. I clutched the hand towel in which the blood pooled itself into the shape of a small eye. But anyway, no, this is my regular voice, I said to the doc then, embarrassed. But he would have none of it. Said he'd better take a look, open wide. I was obedient. Wow, he said, you have 2 exactly matching compressions on your vocal cords. He continued, I guess you're right. I guess this is just the way you were born. Wouldn't it be nice if everybody could be that way for everybody? Just a quick listen to the vocal cords, a quick look down the throat. Would make it perfectly clear that this is just the way that you were born? I kind of fucked that up at the end there, but let me read one of yours.
Okay.
Mini Musics, Limit Series, Ring Sold. Soldered near epigraph is myriad lives like blades of grass yet to be realized. Bow as they pass the shams. Portland goddamn band. Fuck you, 2003.
Great out. Okay,
19, blue suitcase, dream walker. I do not believe it was just a container. That only within it mattered. Let me get it right. Do not believe it was just a container. That only within it mattered. I do not believe the blue suitcase itself was not a real consequence. I believe that one called the architect sent the suitcase back through time in an effort to save human history itself. After a destructive course, help us, help him. We were back at the ship, we six long-time brothers, again navigating the wide, wide sea, free of land, free of how land binds man to a place, a sense of possession, laws to guard his possession, weapons to defend those laws, as nicely articulated. No man owns the sea, no more than he can keep and cage and name his dreams, I observed to Macedonia, close, right?
Soyadana.
That first day out. Excuse me, I didn't remember. We're relaxed against the deck railing, her auburn hair billowing about her. She smiles me quietly. My aunt would say that this world lets us loose to play a while, and what we return to her with it isn't in our hands. Everyone kept needless busy that first day, mending fixed things, ordering sorted shells, studying maps empty of land, eating little at dinner, and retiring too early to his long-held cabin, each to his long-held cabin. None trespassed each other's by chance, so I lay quietly in my bunk, rooting my mind like an old addict for hours, wondering if anything in it would help us. Fell asleep, like often, to the flutter of birds singing and chuckling, in the midst of a girl with such a long... In their midst, a girl with such long, tangling hair. Excuse me. Next day, not far out to sea, something loose for me, the air, sweeter to breathe, easier. No land. Our first day beyond land is sinking grass. Roddy and Old Arm who spied the dolphins beside us, made to leap and ride in, laughing fail. Thus found all six of us arrayed on deck, our supper a good one, our tankards given directly from the barrel Francisco had rolled up from below. At thus properly enjoyed, with quiet and attention, the moon waxing to light our new cheer. Everyone an old story, a rousing song, the king was usual riddle none us, the king his usual riddle none of us have ever solved. Cease the tide by cursing the moon, crush the drumheads, men will pound their stones twice harder. Find a woman's fire, and she will lay dreaming coming stars. Everyone laughs. None has ever an answer. You retired first of all. Didn't look tired. A glint that didn't tell sleep's lure. I wondered and nodded with the rest and drank on. Roddy and I laughed at it as often. His talk of the white woods, his shacks, leather bucket, friend with the red whiskers, his heart, willing owned by those places and years. Yet he left. Did. A nod, there's nothing else. This sudden sharp look upon me. We'll need you when we arrive. 'Tis no sane place we travel to. We'll need all of us. A hand on his rocky shoulders and a shuffle of head. But no birds of mine, no long-haired lost loves. My dreams, numb of picture, word, advice. Neither waking or sleeping, stand. To my desk is a pile high of old books, dusty, useless. Then a look at the vials and flasks and herbs and powders, sleepless. I sort through them, sniff a little, taste a little, begin to mix them together, eyes half shut, focusing on our task. This coming island, coming glare, coming cove, coming beast. Do I sleep with eyes open, continue to mix crumpled powders, add mixture? I swipe my finger into the pouch my father gave me when he knew me old enough to be neither singer nor cheerful peddler of pots like he. Find your valuables and find what your valuables are in this world. Keep them in here. Think of me, these old years. An image before me briefly. spread of fresh, warm blood on a log, a huge axe in the sky, chopping his twine. Fewer steps than possible up to the deck in the golden pink and dawn of the horizon. And there, not possible, land? An island where no map would claim one. I shout my brothers away. Shout and shout them years for this, for fucking this. Sober as schoolboys found by a creature caught with a hand down the giggling pink panties, lips tasting her hard virgin's nipples, we stand side by side and behold the living object of our years-long quest. Each hoarsely waiting for the others to speak a word, snap this silence and make us men again. 'Tis Francisco, goodness love him, reading my mind as he often did on my face. My mind as he often did on my face. She was no virgin. Alas. Fuck. Spell snapped. We're ready to cast our longboats into the water, anchors down. Ready? Never a question, we all go in. Nor answers for what this intent is first time. Weapons, no. Food, extra clothes, yes. Bed rolls, tents. Make sure to bring my pouch of dream powders. Few words, enough to pack the boat, get everybody aboard. As I clumsily climb from larger to smaller vessel, the image recurs before me, like painted on a curtain I press near. I wave it off, and again, nobody notices. Perhaps the king dissipates of its own wind. We row closer and closer to the shoreless rocky ledge. Just then, I notice the clear blue green waters, something darker blue, solid, not belonging where it is. I reach for it, grunt, and order to the rest. Steer this way. There's something. What's that? I don't know. A little nearer. I don't know. I don't know.
Sure.
I'm done. I did.
You did?
Yeah, okay.
You can read on if you want.
Okay. I'll do it.
All right.
I'll do it.
Okay.
I'm enjoying them, whoever's reading them.
Yeah, really, I love you reading them, man. This is awesome. It's like a birthday present.
It's a fucking birthday
spa
present.
Weekend.
It's my spa weekend, getting to hear my poem read by Victor. I'll go with that. I'll take what I can. That's a nice one.
19 mirror, sorry, Don. Oh, God, I'm doing this. It's like you got to get the first line in, and it's like you kind of just crumble into the rest of it. Right? Like, if I could just read the first line, I'll be okay.
They are rather long lines.
I don't know what I feel as we ride into the king's old homelands, the sufferings of these people like my own, like it happens everywhere in this world I felt so long ago, before I can recall it. I don't know what to think as I see our king leap more than fall in love with Deirdre, who I know before he does is also from Amandia, also fallen from here, a place far and gone. So knowing neither, just that here is where we are until we learn something, I give myself to tending the injuries and thwarted hearts and tired bodies. These are all my brothers now. We free them of their masters and lure them to take up their own way, work beside them to repair, to build, to bond as more than slaves in one cage, wake up to a day's work, sleep under the stars, as free now as they are. There are skills in these people, we find them out. Some are growing, some are putting up solid structures, others sewing and mending clothes, cooking. No longer needing to resist, eluding, hiding, resenting, they bloom. We've done this before many times, but the king is never in love, near at moments to having. Of them all, it was Deirdre alone who waited our departure. We spoke of this only once in all the months we were among them. I found her on the shore one day, where I would find myself break from the hours of mending and building. We sat together in the approaching tide. What do you think that looks like? What's that? Turquoise eyes on me. appears steady. This world saved. I don't know. Do you think it there? I take a chance. Mandia? See out there. Where our lost home sent us. I pause. We sailed in many years. But the home I lost is where I grew. My village, my family, my father, my auntie. She nods and smiles. I stand and touch her hair and her shoulders. Uncertain, maybe spooked, I return to my tent. Lay on a bed of blankets and pillows where I often share nights with my various brothers still. My five, the kingly softened and dreamwalker rush. The tent ceiling flap open to let in the fresh air. Light, the leaves above dapple in the breeze, drift, drift further. Auntie, the last night we stayed with her. Her warning of growing roots as we were here. Her warnings of many things. Brushing my hair with my mother's small ivory brush. Slow strokes, long and pensive. Off eventually. You remember the songs we sang on the island when this magic gate when you were small? Of course. Thorough brush stroke. Nothing. What is it? Do you remember? Do you remember them, Soyana? I gesture, her still brushing. We face each other on my bed, in my same old room from these dark years. The wide, wide sea is as still as it gets. I lean softly through my open window as it gets. The king has probably taken the dream powder and tricked the mirror pool to the travelers I've met approaching our camp looking for asylum, desperate in them. I tell them where to go. What to say, assure them of their welcome. What can we do for this kindness, sister? Anything ours is yours? Simple trade, they take the mirror so I need never choose between my life and my brother's. In return of powder, when the king needs to say goodbye again to his happiness. His lost home, Francisco's pagan. We may not yet save the world. 21.
That's the last one. You want to read it?
Sure.
Okay.
My tent and our new kingdom grows to feel like my first studio, the one immolated by a lover's rage, so much of me destroyed that it was only the loss of this one-footed girl which tinkered up my heart again. I think of that studio as we settle in here more, and I watch the king walk with Deirdre. See on his face a moving light of passion, love. I start to unpack my rucksack for the first time in years, if at all. My mysterious canvas worn by years of weather and travel, your face softer, center of the tree trunk, and seeing images of you around, I talk to you quietly when alone, tell you secret things. Hearts, a lonely heart space. As I set out the treasures I've collected on my travels, packed away for so long, I describe to you why each choice. You listen. Your seething companions listen. This unknown. This glass face. Small, thin neck, translucent green. For when I miss the sea by our years in the white wood, sit on a small table, very small, next to my bed, blankets and pillows, lifted up to study, laugh. Also, for what when I miss the trees by our years on the sea? A round copper metal pot with a cap and a long spout, furnished with a nigh black. My mother loved little cups, liquid chocolate bubbling hot. Hers not a peddler's trifle like this one. I try to remember precisely my tent in the strange land, years and miles and more. Her accent spiraling down at me, a minute more framing, save your tongue. This onyx figures, twisted lovers, seeming infused, the hands, the hips, the thighs, two women, or one with her man, four breasts, or two of, and something else, falling asleep is studied on this in my hands. Its uncertain narrative flinging itself further into my dreams. She lived in my first studio, my lover, my servant, my slave, my something. The only gift my father gave to me was a smile, assembled, customized by his precise hands.
He told me a man has to learn his way without consequence, without punishment, and for being green. She contained parts from her own, as his father had done too with his. When you're ready for the deeper mysteries, disassemble her, toothcase, and keep her tucked away for another. She molded to my desires, yet I thought her to be mercurial, elusive, grow older, younger, more pliant, more violent. With all the whim she possessed, I took her apart many times, replacing surface and drives, testing possibilities. I taught her to paint. I taught her the kind of dreaming mixed with mathematics and fucking. I built her a curtain perch in that studio for watching me fuck other women. Two or three of them, watching me paint while they fucked each other. I stopped. I resumed. I showed her my paintings of that white birch, my first, my efforts to restore it never finished. Saying what next to you, lying in this imitation of that picture, and yet real, and yet my friend, companion, something stall, say. She pointed out the cuts in the picture were. She pointed out that the cuts in the picture were intentional, were part of the painting, not attacks upon it. That night, I fucked her in a different way. I gave her all of myself, stripped myself of young clumps of love, and melted through the bubbling chocolate like her. Then the door opened, a familiar hat-like sense I crawled from the incinerations. The rest of my rucksack still packed in my cabin below. Even though in slouched pink stone, dark, inert, still, I left inert since I left the city, found my friend, found my brothers. I set you up on the deck of our ship, a far corner I'd always used for painting. Though I'd not yet set you up there. My brushes, my palette paints. 2 days out to sea, nearing an island. I've never thought to do this, but we're going there too fast. This feels like an incineration. Close my eyes, listening to the choppy humming of the wide world sea. Sniff once, twice, fill my lungs full of tangled air, remove my cloak, take off the strange worn hat that I've long kept, and paint it. Begin to paint, do not open my eyes. I begin to paint. I am walking alone in pathless woods, no lovers, no brothers, following nobody, followed by nobody. Brush swiping canvas like I'm an additional arm hand, like I am two, one painting, one now running. Run and run and run, and then begin to approach, slower now, and approaching. Coming upon myself and what I'm rendering, now just one of me again, painting furiously, breathless, hurting. I'm watching it happen again and again, and painting it. How sharp it is, how it slices air itself upon the downward fall of the log. I follow it through its slice, ranting fibers like they're simply cool air and the blood. The blood hesitates. A long moment pouring out, spreading on the ground. I cry, moan, my eyes still shut, pain. Relive this again and again until I feel many hands grasp me. My shoulders, my waist, pull me back from my caging past. Smack my face and unmask me. Cry my name again and again. Franny! 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 Francisco, wake up. We need you.
All right. Nice.
That's fun.
Sweet. Thank you. Well, I have one more poet to read, and then I think we should call it a night for this. And I think we'll cover a lot of good ground. So the theme seems to be, I've been introducing you by way of their poetry to people that I've met recently online. It's writing online. And it's kind of new for me to invest in people at a distance. I guess I do it once in a while. I mean, people I haven't met in person or anything. But it just happened with several people, the Patrick, Jean, Frank, you know? We read that. That was cool. And Tomorrow, we're talking about. And the third one of note of recent times in terms of discoveries online and getting to be, you know, connected, is this guy Ace Bogus, who I guess has published a lot of stuff. And I didn't realize it when I first published his stuff, but he went to prison for like it was like addiction stuff. He was like robbing
like a pharmacy.
Because he'd gotten addicted to labor. Yeah. But it wasn't like grass or something, it was like pills.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And so he went to prison.
Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah, he went to prison, he got caught, he went to prison. And while he was in prison, he wrote a book of poems. And so I picked out a few from this. They're really fucking good. I mean, this guy's in prison and he's writing this shit, and it really made a strong impression on me, so I thought we'd just read these. Prison View. First moon in 5 months, full outside my window at the Martinsburg Correctional Center, where I've just arrived 6 hours from my former jail home. Same spare walls, spiritless meals, but new clothes and a new view. A field of short grass, scrub and dirt, like a nature preserve in Kenya. Vast, unreachable sky, few stars and moon. I cling to that great dot in these hardest nights of hardest days. It warms me with love, like a faded, broken valentine. Swears, I'll see you again. I'll wait for you. I will.
You know what that says to me? Is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So, like what he's saying there.
Yeah.
First moon in 5 months, fall at 7 in a window at the Martinsburg Correctional Center, where I arrived 6 hours from my former jail home. Same spare walls, fearless meals, same clothes, and a new view. He's fucking sober.
Yeah.
He's sober, so now he's writing from the perspective of being somebody sober in jail and being grateful for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's really insightful, Victor. So he goes on, the prisoner's gospel. Blessed are the broken, for they carry their justification with them like a union card. Blessed are the first offenders, for theirs is the kingdom of second chances. Blessed are the unloved, for they shall suffer only for themselves. Blessed are the flight risks, for they still have places to go. Rejoice in influenza, medicated, sleeping away the days. But woe unto he who has learned to hope, for his eyes are stained glass windows in a crypt. And woe unto husbands who see their wives remembering life without them. Yes, and blessed are the broken, and woe unto the broken, and rejoice in the breaking, for such men find peace in their pieces, rebuild themselves. A monument with scars, a book of the word with shattered spine, duct tape keeping its guts from the cold stone floor.
That's fucking
amazing. That was awesome. Yeah. All right. Freedom. The color of midnight, clear and quiescent, scented with riverbanks, seed heads, tall grass, life. Its touch is a woman's, impassioned and safe as the sulfur skull of a foot-long match. Yet sometimes chilly as a lake wind and covering everything like dust. It tastes, too, like charred bacon, cherry and molasses. A man would certainly swallow it whole if he knew its bottle had a bottom at all. Well, that's freedom. Next one. But when they drop the bad news on you, then what the hell will you do? From David Balducci, The Simple Truth. Say to yourself, at least it can't get worse, although it does. Your victim shows, curses you with eyes swearing. Your many pretty wounds are glitter glass compared with diamonds shimmering in his skin. 25, the judge says, while you wonder if that's days or weeks. Then in a few hours or maybe a year, your lawyer develops cancer of the skin and no longer takes your calls. Your friends lose themselves to madness, heroin, something else they caught while petting spider monkeys at the zoo. By now you're so exhausted when your wife requests, let's separate, your mind sighs, woo, we already have, until you figure out she's not measuring space between but what cement she's using for the break. All you can pray as you kneel to gather your entrails off the floor is, I hope he's a priest, so at least someone might be there to pour the shots of liquor at your wake. Yep, one more. Good stuff, huh?
Let me do it.
Oh, you want to do it? Okay, great. Yeah.
From the moment he pulls into the driveway, he studies the symmetrical box of his residence. Two stories of rusty brick and weak gutters, rolling windows, storm-sealed doors, strictly double-locked. On the lawn, a lady crab apple, his short pink arms not catching the level above. He makes himself a burglar in his own bungalow then. Frustrated, reaches for his key or the garage door remote. Earlier, a big cat hidden by the neighbor's hiding panic grass. He lurked in the loft at the mini mall, observing the zip in and shuffle out patrons, tobacconist, pharmacy, tanning bed, and built bookstore. He would take them one motion, a swift whack, and it's off with a wallet or package containing blood. Society doesn't want a grocer who dreams, said Sartre. For the extent that he's a dreamer, he's that much less of a grocer. How easily, I didn't mention Sartre here, how easily the meek become the monsters. That's Sartre right there. Mm. How easily the meek become the monsters, lacking only the boiling blood of action. Such a man might make murder in one transcendent vision of himself. What keeps him contained behind the old woman who lingers too long at the ATM? Why does his hand tremble before the carver's fang? Revolver is a booming brimstone voice, a quiet rod or ball bat. When night comes, he disrobes with the ease of ritual prayer, creeps into bed, and holds his lover sleeping to his chest as though he's innocent beside her. But his head is full of wonder, a field of plowed soil, sown with possibilities. Only once he stirs from rest, gets up, and goes to check the deadbolt on the door. And he is worried about thieves.
That's some great shit, man.
See when he got home.
He published a book called The Prison Poems, and he sent me the manuscript. So those are a few selected pieces from that overall work that described all the different experiences he had there, the chronology from beginning to end. Even with it in Tick, I mean, he's got a real nice touch with language. He has a way of, as you can see, he has a way of like taking these really harsh, visceral situations and giving them that little weird, surreal lilt.
Try to give them a little silver lining.
Yeah. I mean, there's something where he's really paying attention. He gives it precise.
You have nothing but time there.
Right. Yeah, and it's a nice cold eye.
Yeah.
You know,
because you have nothing but time.
Right.
That's how your eye develops, because it's a cold eye. It's a long lizard eye.
Right. So I told him I'd pick out those, and I said, you are really fucking good, and I want you to know that straight up. You are really good, and it's my pleasure to publish your work and help you promote it as I can. Because yours is the kind of work that I just don't encounter it all that often. And we'll call this a climax to our party. We'll move on to further drugs and further mayhem.
Okay.
All right. So this is called On Keeping a Notebook by Joan Didion. That woman Estelle, Deno reads, is partly the reason why George Sharp and I are separated today. Dirty crepe tachine wrapper, hotel bar, Wilmington RR, 9:45 a.m., August, Monday morning. Since the note is in my notebook, it presumably has some meaning to me. I studied for a long while. At first, I have only the most general notion of what I was doing on an August Monday morning in the hotel of the in the bar of the hotel across from the Pennsylvania Railroad Station in Wilmington, Delaware, waiting for a train, missing one, 1960, 1961, why Wilmington? But I do remember being there. The woman in the dirty crepe de chine wrapper had come down from her room for a beer, and the bartender had heard before the reason why George Sharp and she were separated today. Sure, he said, and went on mopping the floor, you told me. At the other end of the bar is a girl. She's talking pointedly, not to the man beside her, but to a cat lying in the triangle of sunlight cast through the open door. She's wearing a plaid silk dress from Peck and Peck, and the hem is coming down. Here's what it is.
The girl had spin on the eastern shore, and now she's going back to the city, leaving the man beside her, and all she can see ahead are the viscous summer sidewalks and the 3 a.m. long-distance phone calls that will make her lie awake and then sleep drugged through all these steaming mornings left in August, 1960, 1961, because she must go directly from the train to lunch in New York. She wishes that she had a safety pin for the hem of this plaid silk dress, and she also wishes that she could forget about the hem and the lunch and stay in the cool bar that smells of disinfectant and malt and make friends with the woman in the crepe de chine wrapper. She's afflicted by a little self-pity, and she wants to compare Estelle's. That is what it was all about. Why did I write that down? In order to remember, of course, but exactly what was it I wanted to remember? How much of it actually happened? Did any of it? Why do I keep a notebook at all? She's such a badass. It is easy to deceive oneself on all these scores. The impulse to write things down is a peculiarly compulsive one, inexplicable to those who do not share it. Hell yeah. Useful only accidentally, only secondarily in the way that any compulsion tries to justify itself. I suppose that it begins or does not begin in the cradle. Although I have felt compelled to write things down since I was 5 years old, I doubt that my daughter ever will. She's a singularly blessed and accepting child, delighted with life exactly as life presents itself to her, unafraid to go to sleep and unafraid to wake up. Keepers of private notebooks are a different breed altogether. Lonely and resistant rearrangers of things, anxious malcontents, children afflicted apparently at birth with some presentiment of loss.
Presentiment.
Yeah. My first notebook was the Big Five tablet, given to me by my mother with the sensible suggestion that I stop whining and learn to amuse myself by writing down my thoughts. She returned the tablet to me a few years ago. The first entry is an account of a woman who believed herself to be freezing to death in the Arctic night, only to find when day broke that she'd stumbled onto the Sahara Desert where she would die of the heat before lunch. I have no idea what turn of a five-year-old's mind could have prompted so insistently ironic and exotic a story, but it does reveal a certain predilection for the extreme which has dogged me into adult life. Perhaps if I were analytically inclined, I would find it a truer story than any I might have told about Donald Johnson's birthday party or the day my cousin Brenda put kitty litter in the aquarium. So the point of my keeping a notebook has never been, nor is it now, to have an accurate factual record of what I've been doing or thinking. That would be a different impulse entirely, an instinct for reality which I sometimes envy but do not possess. At no point have I ever been able to successfully keep a diary. My approach to daily life ranges from the grossly negligent to the merely absent, and on those few occasions when I tried dutifully to record a day's events, boredom has so overcome me that the results are mysterious at best. What is this business about shopping, typing piece, dinner with E, depressed? Shopping for what? Typing what piece? Who is E? Was this E depressed or was I depressed? Who cares? In fact, I have abandoned altogether that kind of pointless entry. Instead, I tell what some would call lies. Now I see. Oh, here comes the rabbit hole. That's simply not true, the members of my family frequently tell me when they come up against my memory of a shared event. The party was not for you. The spider was not a black widow. It wasn't that way at all. Very likely they are right, for not only have I always had trouble distinguishing between what happened and what merely might have happened. Oh my gosh. But I remain unconvinced that the distinction for my purposes matters. I feel like there's everything. Oh my gosh. The cracked crab that I recall having for lunch the day my father came home from Detroit in 1945 must certainly be embroidery, worked into the day's pattern to lend verisimilitude. I was 10 years old and I remember the cracked crab. The day's events did not turn on cracked crab, and yet it is precisely that fictitious crab that makes me see the afternoon all over again, a home movie run all too often, the father bearing gifts, the child weeping and exercising family love and guilt, or
That is what it was to me. Fucking Christ. This is awesome. Similarly, perhaps it never did snow that August in Vermont. Perhaps there never were flurries in the night wind. And maybe no one else ever felt the ground hardening and some are already dead even as we pretended to bask in it. But that was how it felt to me. And it might as well have snowed, could have snowed, did snow. How it felt to me. That is getting closer to the truth about a notebook. I sometimes delude myself about why I keep a notebook. Imagine that some thrifty virtue derives from preserving everything observed. See enough and write it down, I tell myself, and then some morning when the world seems drained of wonder, some day when I am only going through the motions of doing what I'm supposed to do, which is write, on that bankrupt morning, I will simply open my notebook, and there will be a forgotten account with accumulated interest, paid passage back to the world out there, dialogue overheard in hotels and elevators and at the hat check counter in pavilion. One middle-aged man shows his hat check to another and says, "That's my old football number." Impressions of Bettina Epfecker and Benjamin Sonnenberg and Teddy, Mr. Acapulco Stouffer. Careful epicures about tennis bums and failed fashion models and Greek shipping heiresses, one of whom taught me a significant lesson, a lesson I could have learned from F. Scott Fitzgerald, but perhaps we must all meet the very rich for ourselves. By asking when I arrived to interview her in her orchid-filled sitting room on the second day of a paralyzing New York blizzard, whether it was snowing outside. I imagine, in other words, that the notebook is about other people, but of course it is not. I have no real business with what one stranger said to another at the hat check counter in Pavilion. In fact, I suspect that the line, "That's my old football number," touched not my own imagination at all, but merely some memory of something once read. Probably the 80-yard run. Nor is my concern with a woman in a dirty crepe de chine wrapper in a Wilmington bar. My stake is always, of course, in the unmentioned girl in the plaid silk dress. Remember what it was to be me. That is always the point. Remember what it was to be me. It is a difficult point to admit. We are brought up in the ethic that others, any others, all others, are by definition more interesting than ourselves, taught to be diffident, just the side of self-effacing. You are the least important person in the room, and don't forget it, Jessica Mitford's governess would hiss in her ear on the advent of any social occasion. I copied that into my notebook because it is only recently that I've been able to enter a room without hearing some such phrase in my inner ear. Only the very young and the very old may recount their dreams at breakfast, dwell upon self, interrupt with memories of beach picnics and favorite Liberty Long dresses and the rainbow trout in a creek near Colorado Springs. The rest of us are expected, rightly, to affect absorption in other people's favorite dresses, other people's trout. And so we do. But our notebooks give us away. For however dutifully we record what we see around us, the common denominator of all we see is always, transparently, shamelessly, the implacable eye. We are not talking here about the kind of notebook that is patently for public consumption, a structural conceit for binding together a series of grateful pensées. We are talking about something private, about bits of the mind's string too short to use, an indiscriminate and erratic assemblage, meaning only for its maker. And sometimes even the maker has difficulty with the meaning. There does not seem to be, for example, any point in my knowing for the rest of my life that during 1964, 720 tons of soot fell on every square mile of New York City. Yet there it is in my notebook, labeled fact. Labeled fact. Nor do I really need to remember that Ambrose Bierce liked to spell Leland Stanford's name. Leland Stanford, where like L is the pound sign, English pound, right, and Stanford is the dollar sign. Or that smart women almost always wear black in Cuba, a fashion hint without much potential for practical application. And does not the relevance of these notes seem marginal at best? The following notes. In the basement museum of the Inouye Country Courthouse in Independence, California, sign pinned to a Mandarin coat. This Mandarin coat was often worn by Mrs. Minnie S. Brooks when giving her lectures on her teapot collection. Redhead getting out of car in front of Beverly Wilshire Hotel, chinchilla stole, Vuitton bags with tags reading, Mrs. Lou Fox, Hotel Sahara,
Vegas. Well, perhaps not entirely marginal. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Minnie S. Brooks and her manner and coat pull me back into my own childhood, for although I never knew Mrs. Brooks and did not visit Inyo County until I was 30, I grew up in just such a world, in houses cluttered with Indian relics and bits of gold ore and ambergris and the souvenirs my Aunt Mercy Farnsworth brought back from the Orient. It is a long way from that world to Mrs. Lou Fox's world, where we all live now, and is it not just as well to remember that? Might not Mrs. Minnie S. Brooks help me to remember what I am? Might not Mrs. Lou Fox help me to remember what I am not? But sometimes the point is harder to discern. What exactly do they have in mind when I noted down that it cost the father of someone I know $650 a month to light the place on the Hudson in which he lived before the crash? What use was I planning to make of this line from Jimmy Hoffa? Quote, I may have my faults, but being wrong ain't one of them. End quote. And although I think it is interesting to know where the girls who travel with the syndicate have their hair done when they find themselves on the West Coast, will they ever make suitable use of it? Might it not be better off just passing it on to John O'Hara? What is a recipe for sauerkraut doing in my notebook? What kind of magpie keeps this notebook? He was born the night the Titanic went down. That seems a nice enough line, and I even recall who said it. But is it not really a better line in life than it could be in fiction? But of course, that's not exactly it. Not that I should ever use the line, but that I should remember the woman who said it and the afternoon I heard it. We were on her terrace by the sea, and we were finishing the wine left from lunch, trying to get what sun there was, a California winter sun. The woman whose husband was born the night the Titanic went down wanted to rent her house, wanted to go back to her children in Paris. I remember wishing I could afford the house, which cost $1,000 a month. Someday you will, she said lazily. Someday it all comes. There in the sun on her terrace, it seemed easy to believe in someday. But later I had a low-grade afternoon hangover and ran over a black snake on the way to the supermarket and was flooded with inexplicable fear when I heard the checkout clerk explaining to the man ahead of me why she was finally divorcing her husband. He left me no choice, she said over and over as she punched the register. He has a little 7-month baby by her. He left me no choice. I would like to believe that my dread then was for the human condition, but of course it was for me, because I wanted a baby and did not have one, and because I wanted to own the house that cost $1,000 a month to rent, and because I had a hangover. It all comes back. Perhaps it is difficult to see the value in having oneself back in that kind of mood, but I do see it. I think we are well advised to keep on nodding terms with the people we used to be, whether we find them attractive company or not. Otherwise, they turn up unannounced and surprise us, come hammering on the mine's door at 4 a.m. of a bad night, and demand to know who deserted them, who betrayed them, who's going to make amends. We forget all too soon the things we thought we never could forget. We forget the loves and the betrayals alike. Forget what we whispered, what we screamed, forget who we were. I've already lost touch with a couple of people I used to be. One of them, a 17-year-old, presents little threat, although it would be of some interest to me to know again what it feels like to sit on a river levee drinking vodka and orange juice and listening to Les Paul and Mary Ford and their echoes sing How High the Moon on the car radio. You see, I still have the scenes, but I no longer perceive myself among those present, no longer can improvise the dialogue. The other one, a 23-year-old, bothers me more. She was always a good deal of trouble, and I suspect she will reappear when I least want to see her. Skirts too long, shy to the point of aggravation, always the injured party, full of recriminations and little hurts and stories I do not want to hear again, and once saddening me and angering me with her vulnerability and ignorance, an apparition all the more insistent for being so long banished. It is a good idea, then, to keep in touch, and I suppose that in keeping in touch is what notebooks are all about. And we are all on our own when it comes to keeping those lines open to ourselves. Your notebook will never help me, nor mine you. So what's new in the whiskey business? What could that possibly mean to you? To me, it means a blonde in a poochy bathing suit sitting with a couple of fat men by the pool at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Another man approaches, and they all regard one another in silence for a while. So, what's new in the whiskey business, one of the fat men finally says by way of welcome, and the blonde stands up, arches one foot, and dips it in the pool, looking all the while at the cabana where baby Pignatieri is talking on the telephone. That is all there is to that, except that several years later I saw the blonde coming out of Saks Fifth Avenue in New York with her California complexion and a voluminous mink coat.
In the harsh wind that day, she looked old and irrevocably tired to me, and even the skins in her mink coat were not worked the way they were doing them that year, not the way she would have wanted them done. And there's the point of the story. For a while after that, I did not like to look in the mirror, and my eyes would skim the newspapers and pick out only the deaths, the cancer victims, the premature coronaries, the suicides, and I stopped writing the Lexington Avenue IRT because I noticed for the first time that all the strangers I had seen for years, the man with the seeing eye dog, the spinster who read the classified pages every day, the fat girl who always got off with me at Grand Central, looked older than they once had. It all comes back. Even that recipe for sauerkraut, even that brings it back. I was on Fire Island when I first made that sauerkraut, and it was raining, and we drank a lot of bourbon, and ate the sauerkraut, and went to bed at 10, and I listened to the rain and the Atlantic and felt safe. I made the sauerkraut again last night, and it did not make me feel any safer, but that is, as they say, another story.
That's fucking kind of amazing.
Wow. Wow.
Kind of goes from, like, this thing, and then all of a sudden catches fire.
Yeah, she's... She's awesome.
Through the slippery memory thing.
Yeah, she's a real spitfire.
The field trip is going to comprise Nathan D. Horace's reading of his Beck in the Forest chapter from Nighttime Daydreams. That's number one. Number two is Jimmy Heffernan's short essay, The Noosphere as a Collective Consciousness on Earth. And number three will be Colin James. He'll be reading poetry. We had a phone call on July 19th, and since I didn't edit it down, it's going to be in its full, unexpurgated form.
Back in the forest with you. It's like this. You awaken, flip over, and puke hard into the aluminum pot you place beside your hammock. 1,000 colors explode before your eyes in organic, artistic, sculptural forms. As you roar in Spanish, "Yes! Give me more!" through your heaves. Staring into the bright darkness around you are the eyes of 6 other men. Dave Sternstein, with whom you drank last year. Mark Summerman and Ryder Ferency, two friends of Dave's who came with him from California. Don Joaquin Piawahe, your teacher. Another Sequoia shaman, Don Jeronimo Piawahe. Don Jeronimo's son and apprentice, Manuel. The ceremony is being held in what Dave calls the provisional hut, a wall-less, dirt-floored structure roofed with plastic tarps. It boasts a low sleeping platform made of planks and a gas stove and a set of crude shelves stacked with dishes, pots, silverware, and food. A shallow trench around the perimeter keeps the floor from flooding in the rain. You're working on a project that Dave is organizing, building a cultural center for the Sequoias that will double as a house for Joaquin. Half finished, the larger structure is 5 meters away. When it's done, there will be a festival. But you're not thinking about that now. You're feeling a surge of pity for everyone who isn't having the visions you're having. Explosions of the most intense beauty possible, straight from the heart of the universe. No one has ever experienced such marvels. No one has ever seen what you're seeing now, neither your friends nor your teacher, nor the prophets and sages of old. You're becoming enlightened, the next great religious teacher sent to humanity. The only problem is, how will you deal with all the wisdom seekers camping out on your lawn for some face time with you? You can send your disciples to deal with them. Take a ticket, folks. The master will see you when he's done puking. You spit out the last of the ahe, lie back in your hammock, take some deep breaths. In the wake of your soulgasm comes an image of this location in a future some decades hence. In rapid-fire Spanish, you expound the vision to the others. When we get off this planet, we're going to start building genes into new organisms. Not because we want to. No, but because that's what we'll need to do to survive on the new planets we colonize. And that's when the rainforest will live up to its economic potential as a source for these genes. All the plants and animals around us now will become the most spectacular wealth imaginable. Sequoia rockets will blast off from clearings in the forest, and our descendants will take Yahe with them to communicate with the life forms they find. This is how humanity will survive. Gentlemen, to the ships! Ships, you think in English as you fall silent. Archaic. Phoenicians. Greeks. You slip between centuries on a trireme of time. You consider Greek and Sequoia mythologies. In both, organisms transform physically in ways that express their inner nature. Narcissistic Narcissus turned into a flower. Joaquin once told you that the screech, blooping Umu birds had originally been people who loved to laugh. Maybe these tales use metaphor to say that the long-term transformation of a species through evolution reflects the nature of its consciousness. Each species' personality is a way of relating to itself and the environment, and across many generations affects the composition of the body. Alternately, additionally, the old stories could be literally true. That would explain why there are so many similarities between them, so many talking animals, so many metamorphoses. The laws of nature were different then. Dave said the Sequoias believed all humans came out of a cave in Peru. Other tribes have other origin myths. Western science says humans evolved in Africa. Could the Sequoias be right? Apples don't grow on a tree by starting on one branch and migrating to the others. What if the earth is like a tree that bears fruit in many different places? This is consistent with the vision you had last year of time being shaped like a tree with multiple roots, each a different origin story. As you muse, rocking back and forth in a soft darkness where diverse pasts have converged in the present, you reflect that there might be forces in the universe that are smarter than humans are, and might be making things happen in ways that we can't grasp. And what better way to keep secrets half hidden than by revealing them only to people who are, quote, on drugs, unquote, automatically putting the information into question? The spirit world keeps its cards close to its chest. Why? You can't figure it out. But since ancient times, the humans engaged in the project of civilization have gradually steered away from the spirit and toward the material. This has led them to advances in science and technology that never would have happened if they kept on seeking truth in the livers of sacrificed sheep. Meanwhile, the traditionalists in their villages went on developing classic arts like ritual, cultivation, dance, hunting, storytelling, conversation, music. It occurs to you that European pagans used to believe in gods because they were running higher levels of dimethyltryptamine than moderns do. The molecule in Yahe that lets people see visions is also produced by the human brain. Archaic mythology must have been produced by internal chemical effects that attuned people to the wavelengths of reality at which gods are seen. Physicists figure energy as a rarefied form of matter, but they can't yet measure consciousness, which must be rarefied energy. If thought equals energy times the speed of light squared, what would happen if one split an atom of energy? An explosion of ideas? Is that what our brains are built to do? Transform energy into consciousness? If only you had studied physics, you could just about figure this out right now. But you had to go and study literature, as if narrative itself amounted to a form of knowledge. Fucking English major, you think. Fucking words. Your head resting on your left forearm, you yawn deeply and pleasurably, then play with the muscles of your face. You stretch out and crack your knuckles, toes, ankles, neck. Phrases go scrolling through your mind. The secret of life is transformation. That's from Anais Nin's account of her LSD experience. Choose your destiny and have a nice trip. That's printed on a supermarket shopping bag in Quito. Life builds bodies out of matter while souls sail through seas of life and death. That's your own composition. Breathing slowly, you float deeper within the sounds of crickets and cicadas and watch their music forming silver ripples in your mind's eye, as it used to do when you were drifting off to sleep in the summertime when you were a kid. Another sound, a growl. Dog? Human? You open your eyes. In the dim glow of the coals of the fire, Ryder lies wrapped in a blanket, immobile as a mummy, on the boards of the sleeping platform, making werewolf noises. He groans. Ryder is an Alabaman blacksmith with an injured foot. A self-inflicted machete cut, sustained because, Davis told you, Ryder was insanely stoned on pot the day he arrived here and immediately began chopping kindling for the cooking fire. It occurs to you now that the cut was an inevitable and unproblematic result of the natural attraction between blacksmiths and metal objects. If someone works with metal, at some point they'll break their skin with it. If they're so afraid of metal that this never happens, they're not cut out to be a metal worker. A gift of blood is not distasteful to the spirit of metal. The iron and the steel kissing the iron and the blood. Ryder groans. Ah! Mark deadpans. Yeah, but it's fun, isn't it? Ryder bursts out laughing. Mark's the youngest of the outsiders here, but responsible, strong, hard-working. With his little brown mustache and beard, he looks like a Confederate soldier. He grew up in the woods of British Columbia, so he feels at home here. He's a hunter, fluent in shotguns. Dave met him in Humboldt County, Northern California. Dave is the fomenter, the organizer. You sing into the breathing darkness. Hine ma tohu ma nayim. Dave sings back. Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. King Dave, you call out. Here we are again, back in the same old futuristic myth. Dave calls back. Prophet Nate, the rainbow snake. Avatar of Krishna, slayer of the horse demon. The myth never ends. It goes on and on with the interweavings of spirit and body and the ever-purifying soul refining itself. He croons the blessing phrase you received last year. One love is high, and you join him on its echoing iterations. Then the two of you belt out his hit. Every rainbow has a skull for a head. Hours later, dawn is racing across the forest as the earth turns toward the sun, and you're chuming hard after a third cup of yahe. Green light is seeping into the blackness round the hut. The sky begins to rain drumbeats of drops on the plastic roof, and a swarm of horseflies arrives, filling the air with a vigorous drone. Since you arrived here, insects have favored your blood over that of the others, maybe because of all the rich food you ate back at home. You decide that for once you won't fight them. You'll just let them take what they want and see what they have to offer in return. Everyone's equal here. You have to pretend to be dead, lolling in the hammock, one hand on the ground, before the horseflies will confidently go at you en masse. On your back and on your legs they bite you, on your arms and ears. You egg them on. You invite them in. In your mind's eye, you transform into an upscale Italian restaurant and the horseflies into guests. You see yourself serving them food and wine. Bite me! You roar in English at the one stabbing your right temple. The diners pay with horsefly energy of the most intense yellows imaginable. Banana symphony, solar snowstorm, torrent of lemon spheres. It's closing time. Most of the diners have paid up and gone home. You shoo away a few last tipsy customers, wishing them well. You sit up in the hammock and open your eyes. One solitary horsefly, resembling an old Chinese doctor, still wants to work on your legs, and you let it. At least one place where it bites you on top of your right foot you know is an acupuncture point. It moves to your left arm now, carefully, intently selecting places to sink its instrument into your flesh. You guarantee it safety and satiety. Don Joaquin is watching you, a smile playing about his lips. He sees you noticing him and urges, Mate nomás, just kill. After a moment's hesitation, you obey and transform the old doctor into a being of pure consciousness, unencumbered by an earthly husk, with a slap. The crumpled body tumbles into the soft gray ashes of the extinct fire. Later, as everyone was taking down their hammocks, you approached Don Jeronimo. Like Don Joaquin, Jeronimo and his son Manuel had been completely silent during the night. You asked him how he'd liked the ceremony.
More or less, the old man demurred, stone-faced.
It suddenly dawned on you that you'd been rather loud.
There was a lot of white guy noise, huh?
Don Jeronimo erupted in laughter.
Hello, this is Jimmy Heffernan, and I'm going to read for you a short essay called The Noosphere as Collective Consciousness on Earth. If one accepts the notion that there is a non-local consciousness, that the non-local correlations discovered by quantum mechanics are, in fact, real, and constitute a kind of suffusing matrix or network of connections between every point and every other point in the universe and potentially also the multiverse, then it is not a stretch to assume that there is a collective mind operating on Earth. This collective mind operates both locally and universally. The local orientation exists because Earth is specially attuned to itself. Signals generated in one Earth entity are decoded easily in the identical or like equipment in other Earth entities. You merely have to tune in or become aware through some event. This phenomenon ties into the larger network because it is self-same. It is just that the signals from deeper in the multiverse are alien and decidedly more on the periphery as compared with the immediacy and familiarity of terrestrial affairs. When one becomes aware of this collective mind operating on Earth, it is unmistakable, and the observer harkens immediately back to any mysticism or perhaps Eastern religious notions she or he has picked up in the course of time. One may begin to question it as the memories fade, but one never forgets it and is never quite at peace with the somnambulant state of the planet with regard to these matters. This envelope around the Earth's biosphere is called the noosphere, and comprises the totality of the non-local quantum network of consciousness, for our purposes in the vicinity of Earth. When a tipping point has been reached, we will achieve a new level of evolution through a quantum jump in the collective mind of the noosphere. The tumultuous events of the 1960s were a false start in achieving this shift, but they were not random and they were not accidents. They were evidence of a strategy evolution must employ to achieve this necessary mutation. Evolution is not perfect, and its methods are often coarse, so we had precisely what one would expect, a premature form of the mutation that resulted in relatively little. But if Earth keeps trying and gets better at engineering these waves so that eventually the momentum creates a lasting change, the mechanism will have been a success, one in a long line in the history of evolution on this planet. The noosphere is pregnant. One day in the not-too-distant future, there will be a profound transformation of all life on planet Earth. In the noosphere, all consciousness, humans, animals, even plants, and that of Earth itself, is linked into a collective, unified network that envelops the entire biosphere. Many mystics and psychonauts have reported tuning into this array and sensing a unity that exists at a more fundamental level than the everyday. For example, you could be at a good party and observe that all of the partygoers are behaving according to a rhythm that is somehow common to everyone there, yet is normally beneath the surface. Everyone is him or herself, but there is a current guiding everyone's behaviors, and all are in some kind of active union. When the planet awakens to itself, God only knows what it will be like, and the individual and the collective will be one. The noosphere is real. It comprises fundamentally a pool of the energies of all the beings on Earth, and it is observable. It is a conscious multiverse of individual minds bound together collectively in a strange but perfectly real organism of neurological space. Eventually, Earth will awaken to its potential and to the now hidden truths of existence waiting for us farther down the evolutionary chain. Our future depends on its successful evolution. Thank you.
At another point, I got a comment from an editor who said my work was traditional.
So one, so one friend said your work was obtuse,
yes.
And then an editor said your work was traditional.
Right.
And so you decided to put them together in a title.
Well, yes, but I thought, is there such a thing as obtuse traditionalism? And there is.
Is there?
Yes. And the funny thing is that I was, I don't know if you know who Patrick Moore is, but he used to have this TV show in England about stargazing, and he was an eccentric guy. You know, his hair would be sticking out in all these different directions. And I looked it up, and his name came up, Patrick Moore, obtuse tradition. So I thought that was incredibly funny.
Oh, that's awesome. That's very funny.
Anyway, I'll read the poem, all right?
All right.
Obtuse traditionalism. There is something huge living under my tool shed. Flattened down grass precedes a cabin-like entrance. No sightings yet, although my neighbor has seen the bushes move. His vigilance is encouraging, and the motion detector I had installed. We may have pictures soon to inundate the internet. Speaking into a microphone, course. The entrance gives off an odor of musk, some gland or fistula gone rampant. It keeps the curious away, who pester in theoretical camouflage. An expert has predicted a sinkhole down there, that ancient river running beneath all of us. Her idea is to descend when stability is finally confirmed and facilitate an historical provenance.
Historical provenance. I looked up that word provenance because I wasn't sure what it meant, and it means origins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the expert was is predicting a sinkhole that leads to an ancient river, and she wants to descend into the ancient river, and then confirm the ancient river's stability, and then this river will help us to understand origins.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't know the exact meaning, you know. You know the exact meaning of your what you write? I don't know. I know I'm in a general space there.
Well,
I'm looking for imagery, obviously.
Well, I just, like, I was very much enjoying this poem, and then the last stanza, I thought to myself, your poems are so cryptic at times, with very vivid imagery at the same time, and I just looked at that final stanza and I thought, wow, Colin is coming as close as he ever comes to giving away the game, to like coming to a conclusion that is almost graspable. I almost had it grasped. Not quite, but you know, knowing what the word provenance had, it gave me this delusion that I might figure it out. Okay, carry on.
All right. So this next poem is called The Euphoric Hair Bombardier. Now, I live in a small town, Western Massachusetts. And sometimes I have to go get my hair cut, and I'm not a particularly, social person, especially under these type of circumstances, you know, where you have a bunch of townies or whatever. But although I've lived in this town for over 30 years, I guess I don't fit in to a certain extent. And I will also say that this is one of the highest percentage of people who voted for Trump in the town.
Oh, good grief. Wow.
Yeah, so I don't want to hear a lot of the conversations. I don't want to be antisocial or negative, but... you know, so what I do is I don't go to the barbershop around here. I go to a different town. Probably a lot of people do that. They don't want to hear the news. People
yep.
who dwell on the town.
Yep.
All right. So that's what essentially it's about. And then, okay, so this poem is called The Euphoric Hair Bombardier. The captured have become increasingly less adventurous. Walk shortened to the obligatory. Our gestures have almost succeeded in containing them. The simplest central emphasis has them grabbing for their heads with their hands, searching for a wave or a swirl. Mistakes were made, hats employed, then discarded, like transgressive brilliantine. Hair Command immediately banned any comb, brush that is not essential to our work. Hierarchy hopefully will be restored instinctively before we all die.
Wow.
And die, of course, is spelled D-Y-E.
Yes. Okay, so just to give you another thing, so I looked up brilliantine because it sounded familiar, and it was probably still is it's a hair product for it's like a hair gel.
Yeah.
To keep your hair, I guess it, when men were more commonly would slick down their hair back when.
My grandfather used to use it in England.
Right. And then I look up, and then transgressive is, for some reason in my Word document, transgressive has a little red underline under it, which would ordinarily mean, it would mean that the spell check doesn't know that word, and I don't know why, it doesn't sound like it's not a word, maybe it isn't, but I love that phrase, I love the whole thing about mistakes are made, hats employed. Yeah, within the mad little world you create within the lines of this poem, you could see where hats could be a real panic causing thing, you know, like you're in some kind of corporate hierarchy and they're desperately reaching for a solution to the problem, and then someone just says, let's try hats, and then it just goes horribly wrong. So this poem has a nice weird little world to it. It's not detailed in every way, but you definitely create something here that is has its own internal logic, has its own internal activities and persons, and then of course the play on words at the end, the very ba-dum-bum kind of before we die. I'll die. I just, you know, it's very nicely done, Colin. Very nicely done.
Oh, thank you for saying so, Raymond.
I like a good pun as much as anybody else, but I have to say that you especially earned that pun at the end of this one. This one really just, you know, you hit that note perfectly at the end.
Thank you. Okay, so this next poem is called Unusual Obsessions and Their Correct Pronunciations. I suppose it's a vague title, but this poem makes reference to my father. So I was quite young when he died. You know, I was 15. So he is in some poems. Obviously, it affected my life because he died when I was young like that. So anyway, this is called Unusual Obsessions and Their Correct Pronunciations. My father, the avid cyclist, attempted to ride around the earth on his bike backwards. It got a bit tricky climbing the Alps. Right of way confused him. His hand signals, in turn, shocked De Hague. Shared the road with the less devout, the better parade. He had neck surgery in Poland. His profile forever changed. He began to resemble Mr. Potato Head. Despondent, he jumped off the largest single arch bridge in the world. It was the way down he craved.
That last line is beautiful. I love that last line. Again, you, in a way that is not quite realistic and not quite surrealistic, you create a very nice, narrative that it's like. You know, it's like you watch some movie where the premise is absolutely ridiculous, but the way that the movie makers have pulled it off, you go with it. You just go with it because the world seems believable and it's consistent, and it takes itself seriously even if it's funny. You know, it's like it's not there to insult you by using just dumb humor. And so the nice thing about this poem again is that it's. On the realistic surface or whatever, it's ludicrous all the way through, but that's just one kind of superficial level of it. If you dig down just a little bit deeper, there's this really strange, there's this really strange adventure going on here. And it ends tragically. And it's both hilarious in some moments, like beginning to resemble Mr. Potato Head and shocking the Hague, but at the same time, it also has its dark and mysterious downside, and just well done. Well done.
Thank you. It's hard to talk about, you know, three poems. And then when talking to you, you bring out other things in the poetry, you know, which I hadn't really considered or thought about, you know.
I mean, that's the pleasure of someone reading something that you like and them enjoying it and then sort of like looking into it and seeing things that you didn't necessarily see at the time. That's always fun when that happens. These were good and you have lots of fans who I'm sure will enjoy them. How is life going for you in general these days? How are you enjoying summer?
Pretty good. My son just got married, you know, in Boston, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother-in-law came up for the wedding, and she's 89, and she fell in the hotel, you know.
Oh.
So she broke a couple of ribs, so she's staying with us longer, but she looks really, you know, tired. So that's what's going on.
That's what's going on. Okay.
Anyway, I want to thank you again for, you know, publishing these, because I get unbelievable amount of rejections, you know, but I've been doing it for so long, it doesn't faze me, I just keep, sometimes I'm even grateful for the rejections, because I can consider the poem in a different way, and then I revise it and send it up, and it's better for it.
Do you have other journals in the Cenacle that have tuned into your peculiar voice and publish you all the time? Oh, you are one of a kind, Colin. Your work, I've never seen anybody write quite like you. You have an amazing control of language. You have a very vivid and strange imagination. Your poems are funny, but they're not always funny. And sometimes there's moments of pathos and drama that are as valid as the funny bits. And I just, you know, I can understand why you get a lot of rejection letters, because these poems require a little bit of work, and they probably require a bit of an unusual sensibility, and yet, I say again, and this is not something I expected, because I never know, when I started asking people for feedback for the issues, I started seeing over and over again, Colin James, Colin James, Colin James. And so something in your work, despite all those rejection letters, something in your work is compelling. And it's compelling to people that are your peers, people who are writing stuff that is as good as your work is. And so if your work is reaching them successfully, then, you know, you've got the checkered flag, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's great of you to say so. You're going to give me a big head here.
Just keep doing it. Just keep doing it the way you do it, and don't worry about anything. I guess I'm giving you encouragement. And if that swells your head an inch, but you feel encouraged, then so be it. Because I don't know how you would, I would rather you feel encouraged to keep on keeping on than anything else. Because it's hard in life to write things like this, have most people say, eh, whatever, and then keep writing them. You know, you have to have an inner compulsion that drives you to want to write them, gives you pleasure in doing so. But I also think adding to that is getting a little bit of feedback that's just like, you're good and keep doing it. I think that plays in there well, too, you know? I think that's just part of the deal.
Yeah, you got to be a bit self-absorbed, too, I think.
Right.
To write, you know. To
right.
What you're writing.
Well, it has to be something that you do for reasons that are beyond the reactions and rewards or whatever of the world. It has to be something you do because it's what you do. And but I just want you to know that in the midst of your self-absorption and in the midst of the rejection letters from people who don't pay attention or don't understand or whatever, there are also people who say, wow, you're good, and it's a pleasure to read your words.
Well, that's wonderful of you to say that, Rick. Thank you very much.
Awesome. So I will, would you like to say hello to the gathering on Saturday in advance, send a greeting?
Yeah, we're being recorded, right?
Yes, sir.
Yes, yes, so I just want to say hello and thank you for listening, taking the time, and it's great of you to listen to these poems.
Sweet.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. Okay, Colin, so you have a good rest of your day, and maybe we'll have another phone call come the autumn.
Raymond.
Okay. Take care, my friend.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Labyrinthine, Part 11, Section 57. Deep inside, Traveler's Tale, far into the mountains, long years of it, feels like, is this touch begin to thread and glue the scattered things? Sit back. It's on TV, that story in the mountains. It's right there, on that black and white TV, whose grainy picture I have to adjust with the antenna 2000 box on top. But there are no travelers up on that mountain. Not right now. Not a one. Why did I think that? Have I lost track? How did that happen? Look around my room. There's a candle on the big box next to my bed. Some matches from a place called Red Dog Banner. Light it up. My bed is rickety. At best. Thin blanket. Thin pillow. The TV over there I see is on a small purple stool. Looks like an old chair with its back gone. On the wall to my right, there's a map. It's islands. I count. Okay, six of them, of course. They're sort of clustered together. Oh, okay. Something in that. On the wall, my bed rests against, there is what looks like a page torn from a newspaper or a sheet magazine. Depicted a big-bellied man wearing a strange getup. Shapeless cloth hat, a sweater with zigzags across it, stretched over his great big belly. His pants, a clutching design, pulled up too high over his waist. Long socks, pulled up to his knees. Golf shoes? Yes, and a golf club in his hand. Some kind of iron. And look, there's an old golf bag in the corner there. Do I golf? Oh, a white bunny. Sitting down there, near the golf bag, on a little stool, smaller and shorter than the TVs. Looking at me, glowing white fur, fierce, beautiful eyes up on me. Oh, Mesmer, from the Traveler's Tale, and elsewhere. You're not up in the mountains. I see you, foolishly, but honestly. You sit once, say nothing. I look at myself. At the ragged clothes I wear, that's okay. That's familiar, at least. Sit up, legs on the floor, my old boots waiting there. Okay, that too. Pull them on. Stand, sway, steady. Mesmer's still watching me, many times smaller than me, but not really at all. Still. Bring me to the travelers. No reply, not even a sniff. Please, I'm not sure why, but this is how it gets to where it's going. Now I sniff. Looking at my golf bag. Oh, well, okay. I lift up the bag. It's got maybe three clubs in it, but okay. I pull open the door for her, and she hops purposely through it and down in the hallway. I mean to follow, but the hallway is warped to my view, and I find to steady, only way to steady, is to sort of dance my way alone. This works better. So I grew and danced my way along behind my hopping bunny friend and push the exit door open for her. We come out to what appears to be a beautiful garden, maybe the prettiest one I've ever been in. Okay, I've done this before. It's like I'm enacting one of my many smaller stories. In it, I'm a poor, ragged gopher who lives in Pensione in the village and once a week goes with his golf bag and his white bunny friend up those distant gray hills to the white woods beyond and enacts a kind of gulping ritual which it's believed keeps this island from experiencing something dreadful. What dreadful thing? Why does this ritual stave it off? How did it begin? I don't know, or don't remember. I might start here, in beginning to bring scattered things together. How will this help unite these six islands, like shown in my room's wall picture? I don't know, but I follow Mesmer, hopping along, up the Red Hills, and, like practice, begin to... as we enter the White Woods, and thus follow this sun pathway to where a small golf ball rests on a tee, and looking to my right, I expect to see the cut swath that leads to a swamp, which is where I drive that golf ball every week. Oddly, I recall now using Mesmer as my golfing stick, but no swath, none, just White Woods, like in every other direction. I look at Mesmer, whose snippings are many and quick, bespeaking her spookiness. Okay. That's why this. What the message? I kneel down to Mesmer and hold up my arms. She sniffs. She murmurs. So we'll hop near me. She'll make a peg. I begin to walk and hop deeper into these somehow stirred up strange white woods. You walk deeper into the white woods, but I mean not to say like tis an outer area and a center. The white woods has neither. I come to another little open area, another golf ball on a tee, but again, no clear swath to strike the ball through. What then? I look down at Mesmer, and she's high above me in milling. A sniff, a long hop, ears flying back. I pull up my black pen for comfort, but notice it has no cap on either side. What? How? I don't know. You walk and hop on. And I listen, try to listen, distantly, barely. And it's just a box of ring over a ribbon for your hair. Such a long, long time to be gone. And a short time to be there. A black pen with no cap. A golf ball with no swath. A white bunny sniffing and sipping. No deeper, no center, no shallow. Make art now. I sit down on the cool floor of the White Woods. Leaves and needles and other things on this ground. I feel it deep in me, deeper than my bones. Look at my pen, no caps. Mesmer hops in my lap and dozes comfortably. A compliment, her trust. Now what? The deeper than my bones. White bunny napping in my lap. Weird pen. Okay then. I close my eyes. Try to let myself uncouple a bit. Try to stop moving. Really just stop. Okay. Okay. I think. What are these white woods? Are they simply trees? Are they all white? Do they more glow than anything else? Yes, I like this. They glow at night, especially, and maybe the glow is like the... I want to ask Mesmer, though I guess she'll tell me, but she's napping still. Look at my pen. Hey, a cap. Never have I been so thrilled to see one. Of course, I'm also back there, the one looking down at this page and writing just fine. Still, this is my pen and it's working again. Mesmer wakes, hops off my lap, a couple of sniffs, and she sets off hopping fast. At first I make you follow, but then realize she's not waiting and way too fast for me to follow. Okay, it's okay. She's my tender, so if she leaves me be, it means she's not currently concerned at my state. So, White Woods, glows at night. What now? I hear a noise, and along comes a friendly sight. Tis the boat wagon driven by those blue-eyed kitties and their yellow friend, Fish. They pull up to me, and I figure a ride is being offered. They don't speak the English much, but I can figure invitation when it's offered. So I get in the back seat, and they wait for me to buckle up my seat belt, safety first, and then they put their white paws on their shared steering wheel and start to pedal on. It is comfortable in the back of the wagon, a long bench with many blankets and pillows, so pleasant a ride, I begin to doze. Glad I'm here, right here, these glowing trees, these white woods. Wake, kitties are staring at me in their strange but friendly way, and I see we're pulled up before a very strange too and charming house. Oh, tis? Yes, be thought pleased, domicile. I level and get out of the wagon and notice the kiddies and Fred Fish remain in their seats, so I give them a friendly wave and walk up to the front door, not knowing what to expect. Or do I? Wait, get this moment on Straker. I do know the thought pleased, know them well. What difference here? Okay, I've never done this in this book before. Okay, Does that make a difference? It does, yes and no. Does anything not belong in this book that I can write of? Before I knock at that door, let me stop here and ask this and try to answer it. Could go in several directions here. One, I remember years of walking around my old college, long years ago, and then recently returning and walking there again as a stranger. I remember and feeling happy sad over this. Cars 3 is the kind of strategy that Finding Dory does by telling a story that encompasses the first movie, deepening and enlarging its myth. Some prequel elements, some continuation. Chemical Brothers, a surrender double LP on my old but finally working stereo broadcast around my house by very modern Sony speakers. And I remember high blasting this music in a Seattle friend's house years ago when it was pretty new music and it was exciting to know it. And here it and I again now, blasting and high. Four. I wonder if Trump will go down because he and the Russians stole the 2016 U.S. presidential election, or if he will survive, as cockroaches do, get reelected because the Democrats will try and fail to triangulate a winning candidate by focus groups and marketing strategies. Five. My beloved loves when New England gets green and jungly in the spring and summer, in part because she grew up in a place not very either. We have an old Dell laptop named Essie. We've set up to broadcast a kind of photo exhibition on her desktop, a vase of artificial flowers next to her, a shiny mask hanging off a corner of her open lid. Yeah, okay, they belong. That's good. Now what? I knock. Knock, knock. The door opens. There's a lovely-looking thoughtly, large eyes, possibly a tail, furred face and body, friendly smile, wearing clothes like not sure what for. Me too. Tis Flossie Flea. She is one of the more well-known fleas. She has a room big a garden, likes to keep the whitewoods neat, especially her portion of it, keeps a clipboard to keep track. Hello, Cece, she says, quiet, smiling, and coming out. I'm glad you've come finally. We should go now. Go, ask if me. She takes my hand and hurries us along back to the boat wagon. I guess why the kiddies and Fred Fish waited. We get into the back seat and buckle in. Safety first, she says, laughing. Nods to the kiddies, and we pedal away from the flea domicile. Where are we going? She laughs. Her dress is a sort of pale blue with pretty rutabaga blossoms on it. Are there such a thing? Well, I guess so, at least in these redwoods. I think we doze a while because it is a long way. There, wherever there is. But are pulled up in front when we wake. Kitties and Fred Fish napping peaceably in the front seat. Get out, and this time the kitties pedal on, and we wave goodbye. Walk up to a friendly, glowing hut. Oh, of course, this is my hut in these white woods. Strange but familiar. Walk up to the door, which has a small portrait of a smiling imp on it. Once he nudges me and taps my shirt, I pull up my Burning Man 2003 pendant and touch it to the portrait. There's a soft cackle and a click. Door opens right up. We walk right in. It is a one-room hut filled with familiar items. Among them, two armchairs, and we each sit in one. Look around in a very familiar way. My armchair is an old, ragged green one, probably based on the memory of one I had in about 1985 for a few months in the first apartment I lived in. Yeah. Next to the armchair is a filing cabinet. On the far wall, pictures of creatures and thoughtlies. A little bookcase with books on thoughtlies, ghosts, monsters, fluckers, explainers, ladies' toe, imp, pantinos, plus one called I Am's The Messes Flesh of by Madame Goo Click, and the great big book of Bella. The front door, shuttered window next to it, next to our armchairs. To my right, a painting of a fireplace in the wall that really works. Next to my chair, an old chest I know contains blankets and pillows and such, and opening a door in the ceiling with a fishing wire hanging from it, a button tied to the very end. Up there, a very strange attic. I smile at Flossie, waiting. She smiles back, waiting. I'm ready to be interviewed. She smiles again, like I'm not seeming too bright right now. You wanted to know about Lee Fockleys and how we are guardians of the White Woods. Oh, yeah. I had that thought earlier in the week, thinking about what I'd write in Labyrinthine today. Seemed a good idea to chase. She waits. So you are? She nods. Always? She looks at me questioning. I have to recall time is not really something here. How do you do it? It? Guard? You're so small. Another look, and recall they are small back where I come from, but not here. Smells again, encouraging. I try again. Are there enemies? A look. Threats. Another look. Okay. What do you do as guardians? Patient smile this time. Wow. I really don't know how to think of a world not like mine, which is full of threats and enemies and so on. I try something I'm fairly sure of. You grow rutabagas in your garden. She nods, pleased. For the annual rutabaga festival? Nod, smile. To make soup, to share with all? Nod. And in the great clearing near here is a big kettle for the soup. And even in the other times of the year, there's a built-in ring in case someone comes along in need of soup. Nod, waiting. I point to the chest I'm sitting next to. Inside are blankets for any who might get cold in the White Woods. Smile again. I look down, nothing good coming to me, save, why isn't my world like yours, where all are guarded and protected and fed and kept warm? The creature common? I shake my head. Fuffleys have come to my world, usually to pluck out worry thorns from my or my beloved's head. That's how we first met them years ago, before you knew anything more of them. I stand up and push my armchair aside. I grasp the button attached to the fishing wire to pull down the door into the attic. Unfold the ladder and land it upon the floor. Would you like to come? She peers at me closely. Come back and see me when you return, will you? I nod. She smiles again and sort of curls up in her armchair and soon is napping. Okay, then I will. This is section 58. I climb up the ladder and into the attic. It is fairly dark up here, but not quite, as there feels like a glow to every surface, a quality to allow seeing here. And so I begin to walk away from that door, testing if the glow holds, and it does, and my eyes adjust, and so okay, I'll keep going, walking along the floor that is made of rough-hewn floorboards, but solid, and I come after a few minutes' walk to two doors, one green, one gold, and a choice to make. I think, yes, these are the colors of royalty in these myths, these stories I write and live within, but I don't think I've seen them separated like this, a choice between one and the other offered, and yet here it is to go on, I have to choose, and I choose green, hoping gold is not offended, and this is surely strange to think, and yet I do think it. It's what I would think in this situation. Choose green, notice the door handle I grasp is gold, and so maybe it will be okay, I hope, turn the handle and push in, and find them somewhere else, whether really there or a kind of simulacrum. Section 59. I'm back at the Desert Festival again. Really, it seems. And yet again. And I'm wearing a certain hat when I know it belongs to a certain small creature, friend of mine, a furry dancing creature, ribbons in his paws to dance with, a bow above his dark-eyed brow. His name is Perth. I have known him a long time. He does not often speak with words, and yet dances beautifully, and will on lucky occasion pat someone's nose in praise. In the fisher's cap, with a chin strap, one he has worn a very long time, warm and likely his only possession, but for ribbons and bows. Creatures own little, and or nothing really, and yet he has traveled long with these few things. I found it in the back of the old green bus, back in that western city, last bus of the night, returning from the hospital, found it in the very back seat, sort of tucked way down in a dark crevasse, and I thought of my little creature friend, who was often cold, folded nicely to fit his small head. One day, I did not know where he was anymore, and I kept the fisher hat to remember him, and then another day, I did not know where the hat was anymore, and gazed upon sad, seething days, till recently, when dreams nudged into my waking, taking me by the scruff and nudging harder, until one moment I opened my eyes, and I'm back at the desert festival again, and my little creature friend purse, fisher hat, is in my hands. Back then, at the festival, I would sit back down on the desert floor, festival loud and cheerful all around us, and I would look at Perth, and he would keep dark-eyed, look at me, very comely, and now is calmer, because he is a good friend, knows how I get excited, overblown, too full of the drummers for any one of them to take hold, offer a path. Deep, dark eyes, very soft and pleasant purple fur, and I'm very glad for him, and he reaches out his little paw and pats me, lucky moment, on the nose, and I think, how cool you are, how cool you are, how very cool you are. And then he hops off my knee and begins to do his desert dance, a kind of peaceful, frenetic rocking back and forth, the ribbons in his paws and his fisher's hat flying wildly around him, about him, like he can listen to all the human musics, the drumming, the electronica, the cries and laughter, and the desert noises, and the wind, and the celestial music above, and the whirling below, and the earth itself, and dance it wildly, happily, calmly, freely. Oh, shit. I sit up in the faintly glowing hallway, so far away from that desert, and yet here is a little fisher's hat in my hands. And here, sitting on my knee, is my miracle beauty of a little friend, Perth, looking at me, reaching up to pat my nose. Oh, happiness. I stand with him, now in my upturned hand, watching me calmly. We are not in desert right now. It is not those other years. And yet, here we are in this strange new place together again. And I nod, put his hat on him properly, pat his little nose, and walk on to see more. Section 60. One thing among countless I've learned from creatures is that you never know with people folks. We, Bert and I, are making our way along a narrow hallway in the attic, low ceilings, rough floorboards full of gaps and splinters underfoot. I think the low ceiling might even have nails poking out of it. So slow, careful, hunched low, walking for a fair stretch, tiring, and I'm ready for a stop. When a light brighter than the low constant glow thus far. Walk, walk. Try not to hurry and stumble. Come to what is a small library, among the smallest I've ever seen. A green and gold armchair looks old but comfortable. Next to it, a small table with a shaggy lamp upon it. Next to that, a one-shelf bookcase. Upon it, a row of books. I look closer and see they are a series about Mulroney, the space pirate. I had a space pirate burger at Mulroney's, sure, and that TV commercial where cartoon Mulroney takes off in his spaceship crying, "Mulroney's space pirate burgers, they're cosmically delicious." And that Mulroney, the space pirate cartoon show, that didn't last long. But the books themselves. I read them once, well, twice. But it was a long time ago, and I have chased away from them since. Some things become too important. Like, you're starving, and you take way too big a bite of something, and it's delicious, like the space pirate burger, but too much, you're choking, so delicious, I have to spit it out. Have to spit it out. I open my eyes. Whoa. Perth is sitting calmly on my knee. I lean forward, hoping for and happily receiving a furry pat on my nose. And there's a letter folded on my other knee, rough, burnt-colored paper. I unfold it and read aloud to Perth. Everyone has read the five famous books written about Mulroney the Space Pirate. The shortest, mightiest bandito in all of outer space. Everyone knows that when he was 12 in 1951, he had a strange encounter under the starry skies out in the fields beyond the farmhouse where he lived. Something happened that night and it changed him. And everyone knows that when he was a young feller in about 1969, he was part of that other mission to the moon, the one you don't hear about, where Mulroney first became friends to Huckleberg, who drives the famous space tugboat. Everyone knows how the books detail his eventual departing Earth, Terra, homeland, whatever you may call it. He called it many things. And how he made his way by one means and another into the far reaches of outer space. But what nobody knows is that in the year 2042, so far away from those starry skies back in that mythical year 1951, there came a sixth book about Mulroney the Space Pirate's adventures. Nobody knows that. But I'm telling this now, confessing what I know, that there was indeed a sixth book detailing the final adventures of Mulroney the Space Pirate beyond what everyone knows. Now some learning this may get worried and say, oh dear, did he finally perish after all those years? No. He didn't. He found himself a nice, small, semi-habitable planetoid, so far away from everything else, you'd think it was Kansas. But he had those later adventures before that kind of quasi-retirement he went into. It was those adventures that made the retirement possible, because he learned finally how to travel without moving, how to raise his kind of hell without lifting any of his 13 fingers. That book exists because I wrote it. His dear friend, he's your companion. It was a long neighborhood on that nice small semi-habitable planetoid like Kansas. There were two houses, his and mine. We kept them far apart from each other by agreement. I'd keep the manuscript of the sixth book overnight, wake up at first light, walk halfway toward his house. He'd meet me, take the manuscript, securing it under his arm, and we'd walk the rest of the way to his house and continue our work. But what happened was the wind hit, and it blew hard, and he staggered, and he tumbled, and the pages blew all over the place, and there were no woods to catch them, and there were no clouds to keep them from flying away, and my goodness, how those pages flew. They flew all over the world, all over that nice, small, semi-habitable world. We found all the pages we could, but not nearly all of them. It would have been much longer a book. But he was ready to retire soon and just said, let's do with what we have, my friend. Let the rest go. I hold the letter and several pages of burnt paper in my hand. Perth is watching me quietly. Close my eyes and listen. The pages begin to vibrate to in my hands. It feels nice. A strange music moving in and around and among my breaths and beats. Something. A story begins to tell me. All right, and that is labyrinthine for this time.
Here is the haiku from Jude. Okay. Magnolia petals silently fall, new phase of beauty. Between the spaces, all that cannot be said, a life of its own. Today, tomorrow, such lovely abstractions, this breath is now. So many walk this path, today I choose how. Wanna change the world, wanna change myself, wanna change. These words, we are versions of the same thing, let's help each other.
Mr. Algernon Beagle has come to read Bag's End, Book Number 6, The Grand Scheme of Liberation, Rand Finally. On toward the Season of Lights. The good thing about this long story I've been telling you is that I know it has a happy ending. I will say this now because I've decided that some stories have parts in their middle that are more important than their ending, and this is one. Sure, things change between the start and the end, but I must tell the whole story till then and not miss any of it until it's told and over. So it was, last night, in my musician friend Rich America's house, in the city, and he reached home, and sitting next to his daughter, Rebecca, who was under her blanket on the big old green chair, he put me under her blanket into her hands, where she held me nicely. Rich said, "Hi, beautiful." "Hi, Dad," said she. "Did you sleep well?" "No." "I thought you liked my old chair." "I'm sorry, Amabad is fighting, that's why." Rich made Rebecca's blanket warmer and more comfy around us and hugged us both. Then he stated and said, "I know you want to know about me when I was your age. It sort of obsesses you. You know you should, you think you should know that it's kind of your right. Dad, I..." "Well, you're right. I'm all the family you've got. My life is your heritage. I just haven't known how to start. Do you now?" "Do I what?" "Do you, know how to start now?" "Yes, I think so. I walked around the city for hours today, more hours than in a long time. I saw it as it is both now and then, and I saw me, what I am, more clearly today than in years. I realized that I've been scared to tell anyone what I want to tell you. Now, all this people-folks talk flustered me, and I wondered why Rich didn't just tell about the library and the statues and all. He didn't, though. Secretly, I felt glad I'd been there for those things, because right now I was feeling sorely left out and forgotten. "Why were you scared?" Rebecca asked. "Because they've all gone away. It makes no sense right now. I'm tired from thinking and walking. I'm tired from knowing what I should be telling you and being too scared." Rich stopped talking and picked up Rebecca and me in the blanket and carried us into our bedroom. He set us down softly on the bed and made a kiss to us through his fingers from the doorway. He talked again. "Think you'll be able to sleep, beautiful?" "I don't know. Good night." "Good night, Dad." Rich closed the door. Rebecca picked up this book she was always reading and hugged it to her chest. It had a picture on its cover of a girl who looked a little like her. She didn't sleep this time, though. She was real quiet, holding her book and all. I rested next to her belly in the dark, and this time it was me who fell asleep. Next thing I know, it was morning, and I heard Rich's voice talking to Rebbe. I listened from under the blanket. "Hi, Dad." "Hi, beautiful. Is today still a day?" "Yes, love." "Can I bring my Susie Clemens book and my art things?" "Yes, love." "Will you bring your guitar and sing songs for me?" "Yes, love." "And maybe we'll go to Lunacy's Cafe tonight and see old Mr. Knickerbocker and everybody?" "Yes, love." "Now listen, I'm up and ready, so you've got to get a move on. I will be in my armchair waiting." "Okay." "Oh, and Rebbe?" "Yes, Dad." "Bring your bunny and beagle friends." "Okay." "I love you, Rebbe." "I love you, Dad. Now get ready." "Okay." So Rebbe, happy, rushed around for a few minutes, getting dressed, and I waited. I was wondering about that bunny and beagle friend's crack of riches. Then I seed Sheila Bunny on a table next to Rebecca's bed. Now, what was she doing here? We regarded each other, but Sheila didn't say nothing. I figured that safety would be found in me being quiet, too. When she was ready, Rebbe picked us up and brung us with her to her dad. We all went downstairs and out the door. It was cold, not like before, but I guess this was not the same kind of moment as when me and Rich were going around earlier. They walked around the city streets for a while, but no talking. Then Rich talked some all of a sudden. I didn't know how to love. I knew what it was from my memories of my little brother Mickey and how he looked at me, but all those silent years since he died buried my skills. Art substituted for love in my life. He swung Rebecca's hand, some more, and talked more. "You don't have that problem, Becca. You bring to art your vast love, and you bring to love the skills of grace and discrimination art has taught you. You are more dearly precious to more people than you can possibly imagine." "Boy, I wish Ellie Leopard was here to help translate for me when they talked. But, what about you?" "Me?" "Dad, listen to me. You're my whole family, but I don't want any more. Why don't you see how people like you, love you and all?" "I don't know, love." "Well, at least they weren't mad or fighting no more. I was glad over this part." We went up some steps, and then some more, to a place that was all lighted up with celebration. There were people everywhere. I could hardly make out the season of lights in this crowd, but I did. Having Sheila's little body close to me in Rebecca's arms made me feel good. Maybe she knew this is what I needed. She is pretty smart and all. I've been to the season of lights before. It is a place, but it is a time, too, and a holiday to boot. The lights are pretty and seem to roll around like water. I don't know why all this happens, but I hope it always does. Visiting the season of lights of Rich Americus. So we all walked along close and stuff for a while, just looking at the pretty lights. Then Rebecca talked. "We've never come here the first day before, Dad." "No, but I came here once by myself on the first day." "And you didn't bring me?" "I was 17, Rev. That was 3 years before you were born." "Oh. There were lots of people, and if Rich wasn't so tall, we would have hardly moved along at all. But he was like a tall boat, and smaller people around him were like water as he sailed through. Rebecca held at me and Sheila tight, and she kept close to her dad." He talked some more. A lot of my life after Mickey died was spent alone in my bedroom. I listened to the radio, I read, I kept to myself even in school, and got into a few brawls before I grew big enough to be let alone. You had no friends? No. I peeked above Rebbe's arms to see what was going on. I saw the big pretty tree with the blinking lights that looked like water rolling down it. I saw people folks with food in their hands, and I trembled but stayed brave when we didn't go near them. I saw a lot of people folks' children, some smaller like Miss Chris, some older like Rebecca, and some older than her too. It was a pretty scene, and noisy with music in the air. We went through the crowds, and then Rich bent over and whispered Rebecca some words. Rebecca, I was transfixed when I came here that first time and saw those lights. I felt held aloft like in my flying dreams, except that I was awake. But why? I don't understand. You're not telling me what it was like to be you when you were my age. I can't, Reb. Why not? Well, I don't really remember. I mean, beyond the books and the music and the fights. How can you not remember? This is important. Now they were mad again. How did this happen? I didn't get it at all. They liked each other a lot, but got upset a lot, too. Rich got down to one knee and took one of Rebbe's hands, so she had to hold me and Shlila in the other one. His face talked to her hand. Rebecca, when Mickey died by accident in that barn that day, I did too. I don't think you really understand that. Life or circumstances or whatever took him from me, and I turned off, I guess. I wasn't like you at your age. I wasn't funny and emotional and in love with people and in love with drawing and all. I was next to nothing, love. Please understand, I was next to nothing. Rebecca was quiet, but I almost felt her thinking hard like she does sometimes. Then she talked. Is there more? We all looked on. Now, dear readers, this all was too much. I had been quiet for a long time, but my patience and my understanding were both pretty low. So I talked. Hey, Rebbe, how come you got so mad? I whispered. It's nothing, Rebbe whispered back. Back off, Beagle. Sheila growled at me. But this wasn't back then, and I wanted to know. No, I whispered, yelled. Listen, I'm here for a reason, and I have to do it. Rebbe, what do you want your dad to do? Rebecca looked up to her big dad, and I know what she was thinking. I love you thoughts. I want to know what you were like then. She said to him more than to me. Rebecca said all this, and then something happened which had happened before in Cement Park. This pink air came and spread all over everything, and things got strange. Well, stranger. But it wasn't the strangest of talking statues this time. Oh, no. Not even the weirdly familiar in this story. No, sir. Rich Americus got younger and younger is what happened. Tiffy started looking like Miss Chris's own brother, Raimi, who was about 17. The waves of pink left him looking not hardly a bit like Rebecca's dad. Hop out of that throne, Sheila. Confusion is king now. Just kidding, fella. So skinny young Rich Americus and Rebecca with me and Sheila kept walking until we got to this big gray rock tower looking like a four-sided finger, or maybe crayon, pointing at the sky. It had a clock on each of its four sides, but round dots where numbers usually are. I have a hard time with clocks anyway. There were benches on all four sides of the tower. Rich moved close to the side farthest away from all the people we passed and kneeled down. He bowed his head low and closed his eyes. There were benches on all four sides of the tower. Rebecca went close to him and didn't say nothing. I think she didn't know what to do. Suddenly, Shlila pushed Rebbe's arm some to get her attention, and Shlila talked too, but not grumpy like before. Rebecca, I think this is what he wants to give you. This is when what he is now began. Act without worrying about it. What do you want to do right now? Do it. Rebecca was quiet, then she talked. I want him to tell me what's happening to him. I want to be with him. I want him to see me. I want to be what he didn't have after Mickey died, before other people came. Rebecca touched Rich on the arm, and he jumped all scared a bit. His eyes looked funny, pink and cloudy. Hi, he said, all nervous. Hi, she said. I'm Rebecca. I'm Rusty, he says. I can't tell you, dear readers, how confused I felt at this point in this long story. Further and further into the strange. How are you? Rebecca asked the young Rich Americus. Rich smiled and got off his knee and stood up as tall as always. Sheila whispered, Rebbe, don't be afraid. It will be okay. Now I talk too. He's going to be your dad someday, Rebbe, and he's going to be a certain way then that you don't understand. This is your chance to know him better. Now what did I mean? Did we time travel or something? Did Rich time travel? What? Then I saw that Remy looking guy nearby, the one writing in his notebook me and Rich saw during our walk. Oh, yeah. I remembered I was in his story, too, and so I would say strange things sometimes. But Rebecca nodded to me like I said something smart. She sat on the bench, and Rich sat next to her, and me and Sheila in her arms. Rebecca smiled all pretty. You're going to think I'm crazy, but I know all about you. Mitch looked at her suspiciously. Rebecca talked some more. We're kind of the same. We both feel things down deep inside. We want to tell them, sort of. I do it with pictures. You're going to do it with words and music. Rich laughed a lot. Music? Me? I can't play anything. I can't sing. But you'll learn. And you do play. You learned piano when you were little. Suddenly, Rebecca's face got all weird, and she looked over to that old, rainy-looking guy, and she said, Stop this! This is stupid! This isn't science fiction or something. Suddenly, Rich was looking like his older self, and that rainy-looking guy with the pen and notebook was saying, You're right. What was the fucking point, Soulard? Asked Rich. Hey, that's a bad word in there. And that guy has Miss Chris's tail name, too. I don't know. I had something going here, but it fell apart, said that rainy-looking guy. Can a toy have a big brother? Do you want to know what you missed? Yes. You missed what led me here. The days and weeks before this moment came. Where to, then? You tell me? Rich Americus looked away from that rainy-looking guy and at Rebecca. His look was so nice I got all shivering. He talked some more. We need to see the wits, he said. I've given up understanding any of this anymore. Suddenly we were in a quiet room of a big house or something. There was another room in the house that wasn't quiet at all. Me and Sheila were in Rebecca's arms and so couldn't see very much. Rich starts to explain. I don't really know anymore how much of it was real and how much of it I imagined out of a book. Is this a place you came to then? No, Rip. It's a place they came to. It's called the Friendly Club. It existed in the city 200 years ago. Is this what it looked like then? I don't know. I never pursued it much. I just liked the idea when I read about it. These writers meeting here weekly to talk about books and politics. There was quiet then, and me and Sheila both nudged Rebecca enough to get put on a table where we could see. Now there are these other people folks there too. Who are those guys? Whispered me. They're my dad's friends. The one with the blonde ponytail is Dylan. The one with the mustache is Chris. They both work with me at the Arcadia Bookstore and Cafe. I mean, they're there a lot, and they work one day a week. The chubby guy with glasses is Guy. He cooks food sometimes at Lunatee's Cafe. Oh, no, mutters Duda. Oh, fool, yuck! He had me, and I tried to run, but Rebecca held me tight. Wow, she is strong. That bad chubby guy smiled and said, Most people like my food, especially my extra hot chili. Hold on tight. Warns Duda. Yuck, 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 yuck. Yuck, 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 yuck. Yuck, yuck, yuck. But Rebecca was like a mountain I could not climb off. Oh, well, I noticed the chubby guy had no food with him. But anyway, oh, yuck. All this for that dumb pillow. I grouched. After Rebecca had kissed and hugged me so good, I decided to risk everything and stay. Rich was all skinny and young again, like before. He looked at the chubby guy and talked. I want to write poetry, too, Mr. Humphreys. If you teach me how, can I be in your club? The chubby guy looked confused but said, Of course, Rich. Now Rich looked at the guy with the girl's ponytail and talked to him. Do you think I can join, Mr. Trumbull? Why would you want to? That fellow said, Was she like grumpiness? Rich looked upset and looked at the mustache guy. Mr. Barlow? This guy had a nice soft voice. You are as welcome as any here, Rich. Join and try to become content. Now, I was trying not to notice all these strange names Rich was using, but when he looked at Rebbe and said, And you, Mr. Dwight? I was upset as Rebbe was, so she could hardly say, Okay. Rich smiles weirdly. I wish they were more like you. They don't really like books, you know. Not like us. So what if you're old and poor? You like me. You treat me nice. You're going to teach me how to write poetry. Rich's face got weirder and weirder. It shook and frowned and smiled and grouched. Then his head went into his arms on the table. I'm so sorry. I'll make it up to you somehow. I will. I will. Goodness me, I wasn't liking this people folk stuff much anymore. Suddenly, in an alley in the city. Suddenly, we were in an alley even though our legs had not moved us a step. We were all sitting on crates and big cans with me and Sheila on Rebbe's lap. Then Rich talked a whole lot. I listened and listened, and I'm going to put here what he said, but I won't vote me for president of understanding it all. At least he was back to his usual age and all. This is what it was really like with those old men. All that friendly club talk was just stuff of my imaginings, folks I read, and the kind of friends I wished for. They told me stories. One claimed he'd been a lawyer, talked about things he'd read in the newspaper, and said, so many times I'll never forget it. Why must time and again the laws of the land be abused? It's a sin. Another talked about his wife, who was dead or run off with another man years ago. Described her wide hips, described the permanent bite marks she's left on his body, showed us something on his legs. I was never sure. The other one didn't talk as much. He looked at me suspiciously, especially when I didn't want to drink from the bottle they passed around. Night train, usually. I was afraid of it. The other two told me this man was just plain crazy, said they hung around with him for protection, said he'd go berserk if anyone bothered them. I believed it. Then one time, Rich stopped talking and his face was down in his chest. He groaned like he was hurted. Rebecca brought me and Sheila closer to him, and those other fellows got closer too. He talked again. I'm trying for you, Soulard. This is fucking hard, he muttered. I noticed that rainy-looking guy with the notebook and pen. I know. Go on, he said. Richie got calm again. One time, I go into the alley. I'm sneaky, like always. Sacred place. He's the only one there. This crazy one who didn't like me. Says sit with his look. I sit, scared shitless. Starts singing an old song. Tells me to join in, too. Rich then started singing in his nice voice. I didn't know the song, but it reminded me, in a way, of how the older guys in Bags Inn would talk when me and Sheila would sneak out a bit at night and hide to listen. Those were the days, my friend, we thought they'd never end. We'd sing and dance forever and a day. We'd live the life we choose, we'd fight and never lose, for we were young and sure to have our way. We sang and sang. It felt good. I was afraid someone would hear us and we'd get in trouble. We didn't. I forgot to be afraid. I sang and sang with this crazy man. He was wonderful. Ah! Now that stood up in the alley and let out this long howl of sadness. Rebecca held me and Sheila a little tighter, but I think that, like Richie in his long little story, we forgot to be afraid. Anyway, nobody ran away. I was glad when Rich sat down again and talked in his regular guy voice. We never did it again. He never even told me why we did it. Maybe he was blind drunk. I don't know. Maybe he was sober. My life didn't change the next day or anything. I think I even forgot about that singing after a while. It didn't happen again, and I guess I stopped hoping. But deep down, that day changed me. When I met my band and we sang together, I remembered the good feeling of that day and felt it again. And I realized that it was an art where I could connect with people in my life. Not every time, but mostly. Doing it with others, sharing with others, sometimes just others who understood, even if they were only spectators. Rich stopped talking then. He used his arms to Rebecca, and she was so fast to them, I think she had wings. But I was lucky to be part of that hug. It was warm and tight, and I felt protected from all the bad in the world. Rich left the alley with Rebecca by her hand, and me and Sheila in her grasp, and those other guys followed. Maybe what happened next is my fault. Maybe it happened because I got so caught up in all of Rich's stories and sadnesses and big feelings that I forgot for a little while why I'd come to the city in the first place. Anyway, it happened. We went to this place, which Ruby whispered me and Sheila, was called Lunatee's Cafe. She said it was her dad's place, and he played with his rock and roll band Noisy Children there sometimes. We walked through the door, and I saw Farmer Jones at a counter on a chair. Quark! Is what I yelled in puppy language and could talk English words for a long time. I ran around the place like I was nuts. Quark! Quark! It still makes me want to whimper when I remember seeing Jones in Richie's place and all. Quark! I ran from all those people folks there and even Rebby because I was scared and un-Englished again all at once. It was Rich who stopped me. He said nice sounds I didn't know, but I went to him because he was big and strong and his sounds were soft and kind. Or maybe it was because the one thing I noticed that he said was Sonny Boy, which was what my long-lost mummy beagle used to call me. Even in the deepest woofs of dog, I don't forget her. Richie stayed far away from Jones when he carried me over to Rebecca and put me in her arms. She was as close to being Miss Chris or Princess Chrissy as I was going to get there, and pretty close at that. I found my beloved English words then, and the first thing I said out loud was, "Thanks, Richie." Taking on Big Bad Jones. Then I saw Farmer Jones panic and try to run away. Rich didn't let him go. He grabbed Jones around the neck and held him in place. Jones coughed a lot. He's as tall as Rich, but not as big. Wearing his usual worn blue overalls and his straw hat. I think my little friend has been looking for you, Richie said quietly, but Jones didn't talk at all. I don't know why, Ritz said, but Farmer Jones didn't talk some more. Maybe I should crack your windpipe to see if any of your reluctant words are stuck in there, said Rich in a dangerous, threatening voice I know so well from Sheila. But I had to stop this. Don't hurt him, Richie. He has to save my pillow friend and the other pillows too, and me too, I yelled. All of a sudden, Jones knocked his head back into Rich's real hard, and Rich fell down fast. Jones made to escape, but at that moment, Lunacy's Cafe filled up with pink. It was so thick that nobody could move. It was then I remembered again Princess Chrissy's promise that whenever I saw pink, it was her promise that I would be safe. Now it was Sheila's turn to act. Nobody could move except her, probably because of her magic purple eyes. She hopped from Rebecca's arms after giving her a little kiss on the cheek and straight through the air to Jones's head and grabbed tight hold of his ear. I thought I saw her nod her furry little head, and a moment later, she and Jones were gone. The pink was gone, too. But Rich was still on the floor, and his eyes were closed. I climbed down from Rebecca's lap and clawed onto Richie's chest. Everyone gathered around us, but not too close. I crawled right up to Rich near Richie's head to see if he was sleeping good or bad, and then I saw he had some marks on his forehead. I licked at them. Then he opened his eyes, so I talked. Don't worry, fella. I'm a classic vegan self again, and I don't like food except one, like always. But you saved us and all, and your head is hurt, so I was licking you with the last dregs of dog in me, said me, and now I was dog no more. Thanks, Algernon, said Rich softly, with hurt on his face. Hey, you recognize me. I only know who you are in dreams, don't I? I nodded. Is this a dream, then? I don't know. It's not for me. I remember everything. You live in that fantasy land, Bagsden. You write the newspaper. I write one, too, called Galleon's Lap, from A.A. Milne. I know, pal. I've shown up in Bagsden sometimes, but you've never shown up here. I had to. Was it the man who scared you and hit me? Richie, why don't we go to that couch in the back room, and I'll tell you, said me, wondering what I was talking about. Then I looked around and saw the old ringy-looking guy writing fast into his notebook. Oh, yeah, I'm in his story before I'm in mine. Oh, fooey. Rishi brought me to the room I talked about, and he slowly lied down on the couch. He put me on his chest so we could see each other's faces, and we talked. I helped you a little because you were sad, and you have to work hard about your past. See me? Thank you. And you helped me get that bad big guy, and now he is being brought back to Bagsden, where the good big guys will make him restore the states is he broke. But she smiled at me and all my words. You don't have any recent issues of your newspaper with you to help me catch up on all this. Sorry, guy. I can explain more or less, said the new big guy in the room. I hope he wasn't Farmer Jones' big brother or something, but Rick told me, said in my earbone, that this fellow was his good friend called James Real T. I was going to ask what kind of name was this, and was there any fake T's out there, but Jim talked instead. The passing of time was thrown off by that farmer. It was hurried in the place where Algernon's hello friend comes from, where the farmer hails. I watched Jim's blue-green eyes and liked them. They sparkled like stars. He talked some more. Your time, Rich, has gotten slower and slower because you've been living more and more in the past. You regret it and can't make a peace with it. That's where the farmer, Jones, speaketh me. Huh? Say Jim. His whole name is Farmer Jones. Oh, thank you. Sure. Anyway, that's where Farmer Jones got the extra time he needed to make it work. Took yours, Rich. Oh, said Rich, smiling like it made sense. Yeah, right. Jim smiled too. Actually, none of this makes rational sense, but my friend Ray writing all this is, different. He says he's never writes when stoned or bombed, but I don't believe it myself. The old ringy-looking guy laughed and said, thanks, to Jim. You're welcome, Ray, said Jim, laughing too. Different my pa, that old rainy-looking story-writing guy was weird as bag's end, and that's weird first class, but now I talked. Richie, I have to go. Oh, I hope you're feeling a little better. Richie hugged me and said, how will you get home? I smiled all excited. I have a good friend who said this time I could use one of her favorite tricks. Was this Chrissy I meant? What did she sense? Old rainy-looking guy again, scribbling and scribbling away. Oh, well, goodbye. Goodbye, Litsy, said me, and I smelled tricky, and I was gone from there and back in Bagsden, where I belong. the grand finally. The grand scheme of liberation, the grand finally. I'm happy to report to you, dear readers, two really good things. First, the story I have been telling forever is finally to its conclusion. Second, I will no longer be acting weird because someone else has written down my adventures with me in them and saying the known stuff I didn't say or know, or something. I am very much my own singular beagle again. Thank you very much. I left Rich America's behind in the city by way of a Chrissy borrowed magic tricky smile, and now I was in Bagsden in my favorite place called Mirren's Porch, sitting in my comfy armchair. Nobody else was there, and I didn't see anybody through the window that goes to the bedroom I share with my brother Alexander Puppy. Well, now what do? I guess that going to see Sleela Bunny in her throne room was a good idea. After all, the last time I saw that terrible Farmer Jones I had chased for so long, Sleela was holding him tightly by the ear and disappearing. So, I got out of my comfy armchair and clumsily climbed through the window onto my bed inside. I opened my bedroom door into the Bunny family's apartment, but like my bedroom, it was dark and full of nobody. So I ambled along through the hallways of Bagsden until I got to Sleela's throne room. I walked right in and said, "Hello, King. Here I am back again in Bagsden. How's tricks?" Bad move. How fool of me to think that even for a moment I know what was happening around me. Sleela was slouched down in her throne and had been deepening up when I sauntered in. She had a half-chewed carrot, oh yuck, in one paw, and a Jack Kerouac book in the other. I knowed about the who of that book, because I see his picture on it. Partially waked up, Sheila slowly opened one of her purple eyes. Thinking quickly, I hurried to my spot in the corner, curled up, and pretended to be asleep myself. I guess this worked because Sheila adjusted in her throne a little more, muttered, "Dumb beagle," and went back to sleep. I waited for a little while, and then on tippy-toe beagle paws, I skedaddled from that room. Now what? I decided to go see my person mommy, Miss Chris, in her house in Connecticut. It's a tricky way to get there, but suddenly I was there. Miss Chris was in her TV room resting on Susie's couch. None of her family or even that toy cowboy ring of hers was there. But you know who was there with her, right under her head upon Susie's couch? Betsy Bunny Pillow, that's who. Just as I know this, Miss Chris sees me and yelled a happy "Ewa" to me with her hugging arms open. I was having none of it, though. I got kind of crazy and ran away back to Bagsden really fast. There I was, in a hallway, breathing hard from running. Down the hall came Mr. Owl, the teacher at Bagsden School. "Welcome back, Algernon. See you in school tomorrow," he said, all friendly. Well, now, at least someone said something about me being gone, but not much. I wanted answers to my questions about all that happened. When those pillows in the Bunny Pillow Free State had said over and over, "Betsy's busy, Betsy's busy," what did they mean? What had happened to the pillows with the faces? Where is Farmer Jones now? And was these stages that Princess Chrissy had told me was messed up better now? That was it. Princess Chrissy would tell me about everything. I hightailed it to the door to Magiana as quick as my short legs could go. Magiana's a funny place. Sometimes when I've gone there, it seemed like Princess Chrissy's castle was far from the bed's indoor, miles and miles away. But sometimes not. This time I found it very close. I decided to be tricky and surprise Chrissy. Instead of knocking at the front door, I started running around to the back door, which is never locked. Besides, I don't like it when that boop guy, who looks like a turtle but isn't one, has to introduce me to Chrissy with a lot of big fancy words. "Algernon! Greetings, sir! I must congratulate you on your triumphant return to Bagsden," said the boop I almost run down around the side of the castle. "Hi, boop. How's Jix?" "Who?" "Right. Well, no time to exchange heads of syllables with you. Where's Chrissy?" "She's on that confounded porch, as usual. I will have to announce you, of course." Boop was upset, still upset, and all confused. I felt sorry for him. I almost felt sorry for him. Almost. He's littler than me, so when I said, "Thanks, Pat, see you in the funny peepers," and pushed past him, he couldn't stop me. Sure enough, Princess Chrissy was sitting on the porch she'd given me when I was in exile. It's called Bigu Sanctuary, but also 1928 Paris. I don't know what that second one means, but I like it better. "Hi, Chrissy," said me, walking onto the porch. "Algernon!" Chrissy jumped up from the porch's chair to get me and put me in her lap. Then she liked me so much that she had to kiss and hug me. Nice girl. I saw then that Chrissy had been reading issues of a newspaper. Chrissy, what none of those bags and newses will tell you is what happened to Betsy and Jones and the Pillows with Faces. That's because your humble chronicler here doesn't know, say me. Chrissy looked at me with her pretty smiling face and her long tangled hair. So you want me to tell you? I nodded. And she did. At least she told me what she knew, which answered some of my questions, but not all. I listened in her lap while she scratched my backbone. The first thing is that the stasis is back in place. I guess that me helping rich Americans to live in his own time or something helped that. Sheila did the best, Chrissy told me. Her and her purple eyes got Farmer Jones to give up his plan. And now Farmer Jones is not in a fantasy land no more. Chrissy said when Sheila was done, Chrissy herself sent him back to Miss Chris's world. What if he finds Miss Chris's house? Asked me. Chrissy looked sad. He is far away from her house, and he can't go into Bag's End unless Miss Chris and Sheila let him. I asked her how he would survive in Miss Chris's world when it wasn't his own. Chrissy's look got dark and scary. Not very well, but he can't be destroyed. I guess you can never get rid of all the bad there is. No, Algernon. As for the Pillows with Faces, Chrissy told me that Betsy had put them in charge of the Bunny Pillow Free State. Does that mean she's not king no more?
But it means, you frivolous beagles, that my own kind are now leading and tending my own kind.
Said a whispering voice I knowed in my sleep and hadn't heard in a very long time. And there, arriving in Miss Chris's arms, was Betsy Bunny Pillow. I almost scampered off Chrissy's lap to leap up into Miss Chris's arms and give Betsy a great big lick. I mean kiss, but my fears crowded together to spell the word no in my mind to convince me. Even I know that word. Miss Chris carried Betsy to our chair and sat down next to Chrissy with Betsy in her lap. Why did you run away, Elwa? She asked sadly, while patting my back with one hand and sucking her thumb with the other. Oh, yuck. I got scared, person mummy. I don't know why. I'm sorry. Miss Chris smiled her prettier-than-all-creation smile at me, and I know she liked me again. Betsy started making that growling, whispery sound that means that she's getting mad. She's like a big guy. She wasn't getting all the attention, so she had to make threats. So are you still king, Betsy?
My state has no king. My state is no longer in chains, full of slaves. My state is free for pillows everywhere to come and live.
Betsy whispered yet. Oh, boy. How little something's changed. Now instead of talking about Jones all the time, Betsy was probably going to talk about her great state a lot. I could see Sheila getting mad at that. Now, what I wanted to ask Betsy right then was where she'd been all this time and what she'd been busy doing and even how come she had no face. But what happened was that Princess Chrissy and Miss Chris started to fall asleep on the comfy Betsy. It happens a lot, but proletarian souls like your old pal Adrian don't get to rest on the soft Betsy much. So I sneaked away from the sleeping scene and went back to Bag's End. I was frustrated, though, because I didn't feel in my Beagle Boy journalist heartbone that I'd gotten the whole story. Had I tried? Yes. But there were still unknown answers. Being back in Bag's End and things more or less regular should have reassured a habit-loving fella like myself. And I did like the part when me and that smart girl, Lori Bunny, would work together on my newspaper again. But not enough. I'm back, and what is left of the story has been told, except for the important stuff that I don't know. So what will happen now? I added those last words earlier today, and I and Lori are writing these words right now really fast, because who came to see us on Men's Porch but the star of these stories, Betsy Bunny Pillow?
I am here for my interview,
she whispered as she bounced through my bedroom window onto Men's Porch, and me and Lori skedaddled from my comfy armchair for fear of being smothered. So here goes. How do you like being back in Bag's End, Betsy?
That's a stupid question. Next.
I guess your allies are back, huh?
You dumb beagle. Don't you have any good questions? Did you chase my story for nothing?
Okay, Betsy. How come you don't have a face? And what were you so busy doing when I went looking for you in your free state?
That's better. I was busy not getting a face.
What does that mean?
It means that when I went to see what was happening to the other pillows, I ran into Jones' house to see if I could find a way to stop it. I put the pillows with faces in the dark because I thought that no sunshine might slow down what was happening.
Why was I captured?
I didn't know it was you, you dumb beagle. All I made sure was that my traps would keep the evil Jones from sneaking back.
Oh.
Oh, what?
Well, I guess it worked because you don't have a face.
No face now, sure, Bingo.
The interview stopped right then for just a moment. Betsy revealed to me on the furthest end from her pillowcase's opening a sweet little girl's face with pretty pink cheeks and blue eyes, the same color as her dress. Her face is very pretty. The only ones I know and love better are Miss Chris's and Princess Chrissy's. I was speechless. It was magic. And then it was gone, and Betsy left too, and very quietly, Lori, Bunny, and me climbed back into my comfy armchair and sat for a long time. I guess it's possible to get used to anything. Where there was a bunny pillow farm, there is now a bunny pillow Chrissy. Where there was a pillow with no face named Betsy, there is now a pillow with a hidden face named Betsy. And the leaders of her native state have faces, but have orders never to hide them. Somehow, this makes Betsy both a big-shot special pillow guy with a face and a pillow over people who mostly don't have faces. How tricky. But what about all of it? I don't know. In the end, I'm a humble Beagle Boy journalist, chronicler of my strange homeland. Lori left me with a little kiss on my furry cheekbone and my hard thoughts to think. I knew who my next visitor was going to be because I heard her mutter, "Brains." And this had to be Sheila Bunny because it was her voice and her nickname for her sister Lori. Sheila hopped right next to me on my chair and demanded to be covered with my ear blanket, so I did. I thought fast. How does this crazy place change, but somehow stay bagged in too? Don't know, Beagle. Sheila said quietly. We sat for a long time there and didn't talk much more. I think Sheila just wanted my wordless company, and I liked hers too. I fell asleep in a while, and when I woke up, it was dark night, and Sheila was gone. Alone on my porch in my comfy armchair, alone to think all about the crazy things that had happened. This is what I wanted, right? Quiet and calm and no scary things and no big guys pushing me around, right? Right. Except not for too long. I want both, and this is the hardest thing of all for me to understand about me. So the story ends here, but I sure hope there will be more, and I even hope a little that they will be crazy and be about big tough guys like Betsy Bunny Pillow and Sheila Bunny. I hope some of them, too, will be about nice girls like Chrissy and Miss Chris, even that Rebecca girl sometime again, maybe. I hope mostly that I will be there to write them down for my loyal dear readers and fans of my unique home called Bags In. The end.
That was great.
That is the conclusion of meeting number 138 for July 22nd, 2017. It is concluding July 30th, 2017. At 10.02 p.m., and that's good. That's an additional 2.5 hours of meeting we have tonight. So, all good, and peace. Until next time. Goodbye.